my impression from what I can see here is that that was never promulgated, that those provisions, unfortunately in my view, but anyway, and so we're essentially amending the 1998 text, is that correct? Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. I wanted to, as an introduction, explain that everything that relates to parole determination, the parole policy framework really is a matter of, if you want to know what the policy on parole is in the department, you look at Section 73. And 73 was to be repealed by the 2008 legislation. But then in the process of developing, and that's where in the beginning we handed out the background documents on the incarceration framework, in the process of developing that in conjunction with the National Council for Correctional Services, it became apparent that we will be creating yet another system of parole. And then the Van Vieren case came and said you must treat offender in terms of the policy and the legislation that applied at the period of sentencing. So if we now change what was in 73 again, we will be creating yet a fourth system, because currently we've got now three systems if you were sentenced before 1 October 2004 and one system thereafter. And that's why, as I'm going through, this is just introductory remarks, but you will see I've even provided you with a table to show that whatever we're doing in here is firstly the most basic thing that we're doing is we're adapting terminology, because the 2008 Act would have changed all the terminology, but this section was to be repealed by that Act, so nobody ever amended the terminology in 73. So now that we're keeping 73 and not developing an incarceration framework, we had to, as a first thing, change the terminology. That's why you will see there's still the word prisoner here, which we're making, changing to offender where applicable, or correctional center, etc. Then the second thing we're doing, we're cleaning up here and there where there are definitions which are no longer, or sentences which are no longer used by the courts, such as you can be sent for a sentence to corrective training, for instance. We're deleting that. But whatever we do here, and that's why once I've gone through it, we will talk to the table as well. We're not creating any different new parole provisions. So whatever cleaning up process we do in this section, because it looks chaotic if you look at it like this, but it's really a cleaning up process. We're not creating a new parole system that would have been the same effect if we went with the role of an incarceration framework. But so if I could then start, as I said, Section 48 and 49 of the 2008 Amendment Act intended to amend Section 73 in order to incorporate the incarceration framework. These sections are now repealed by Clause 19, which we will come to in the bill. And Section 73, therefore, needed to be amended, as I said, for the terminology and to provide for the deletion of obsolete sentences, for instance, the imprisonment for corrective training and prevention of crime. Pico, can we go to the next slide? Okay, before I come to the table, if we could look just, I'm going to talk us through the amendments on page 8, and I'm starting on page 8 of the introduction. The introduced version, the bill is introduced. If we look on page 8, the amendments in this, in subsections 1, 2, 3, and 4 are terminology. There's nothing new there. It's literally changing the terminology. Then, if we turn to page 9, subsection 5, it's a change of terminology as well as just a rewrite to make it more clear, but we're not adding anything new in here. It's basically just the clarification of the existing position, where we would have started the section with saying subject to conditions of community correction set by such board of court, we've now gone and taken that word and rather made it clear in subsection B, for instance, where we say such placement is subject to the provisions of Chapter 6 of such and such offender accepting the conditions of placement, which is the same as the conditions for community correction set by such board of court, which we've deleted in subsection A. So basically, if you would read the new 5, it's just an effort to clarify the position and the wording that it can read easier for the parole board to have to implement it. In subsection 6, again, it's a clarification of the position. Remember, what the 2008 Act did is previously offenders until 12 months fell under the fell under the National Commissioner's powers in order to place them, and we've increased that in 2008 Act to 24 months. So as you can see in Section 6, we're including now cumulative sentences of more than 24 months to make it clear that it's now, if it's above 24 months. So So subsection 6, again, nothing in essence is changing. But when we get to subsection 6A, capital A, that's where we're proposing an amendment. And this is where we're proposing that the period be changed to a quarter. Currently...
Sorry, Loretta. Members will give me direction on this one. I'm finding it extremely difficult editing it now. Would there be a problem if you took us through page 19 as you have it here now? Do you think it's going to be... Because then at least all members can follow it as opposed to going everywhere else. It's a pity we don't have what you wanted as the final product. But I'm saying it because I keep on saying page 19. I'm talking about this big document that you gave us yesterday. You know, that's one. Because that's what members have there. If you took us line for line on page 19... So that we can go and say we're happy with 73A and then move on to 73B type of thing. I don't know if that's going to make your life difficult. If it's not, I would prefer we do that.
Chairperson, I would prefer for this section that we work from this document because we're not proposing any new amendments. So I'm just afraid if we read on page 19, since that Word document might not be the same as this, I've only looked at the provisions where I wanted the committee to follow if we're proposing new amendments that were not in the bill as introduced. So in this instance, we're not changing anything. We're presenting it as introduced. So I'm just afraid if we read in the Word document, there might be differences between the version as introduced. So I would rather then go line by line on page 8 of the introduced version because we're not proposing any amendments in any colors in this one.
Happy with that because they are not changing anything other than terminology, and we're saying a sentenced offender remains in a correctional center for the full period of sentence, and an offender sentenced to life incarceration remains in a correctional center for the rest of his or her life. That's what we're saying, isn't it? Any sick sentence offender whose sentence has expired but whose release is certified by the correctional medical practitioner to be likely to result in his or her death or impairment of his or her health or to be a source of infection to others may be temporarily detained until his or her release is authorized by the correctional medical practitioner. Are we happy with that? It's very difficult, and I want us to understand it. I mean, in layman's language, we're saying that if somebody has got some infectious disease and there's nothing that is going to be able to look after him outside, we're going to keep him in the cells. That's what we're saying in essence, so that you understand what we are saying. Even if I've finished my sentence and I've got Ebola, for instance, and there's no hospital that will deal with Ebola, la pekaya ba, they will keep you there until they fixed you up. Now I'm saying this is what they are saying in here so that you understand it, that we don't just rush through it and then tomorrow we have difficulties. I'm explaining it correctly, am I not? Okay.
Yeah,
no,
Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. My apology for coming late, sir. May you explain, Chairperson, through you, what do you mean by temporarily detained until his and her release is authorized? What does that mean when a person has already a sentence expired? What does it mean?
What it means, Bob, is that if he was supposed to leave jail today, or leave, like I'm saying, jail, if he's supposed to leave the correctional facility today, but some medical practitioner or somebody finds out that you have an infectious disease. In other words, if you go out and apply, you are going to infect your family or the community. They are going to keep you in there, even if you have finished your sentence. That's what it means in layman's. No, I'm not saying you must agree with it or not. I'm saying that's what it means in layman's language. and you'll stay there until somebody says you are now safe enough to go home because you're not going to anymore infect other people at home. That's what it means in layman's language. It's now for you to agree or disagree with it.
My question, therefore, after the layman's explanation, will that incarceration tend to be a hospital or what? That's my question. If therefore we've been fined that I have a sick, then I can't be released, then it will turn that the incarceration will tend to be a hospital or what? Will my family come and visit me every now and then? What will happen? What about my rights? Because I'm supposed to be out.
Any other views on that?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I don't think that this clause is going to assist us. You'll remember that we're talking about overcrowding, but now we're making ourselves as if we're the hospital. That we can keep people because they've got a disease that is to affect abanye abantu ngaphandle. Ngize apha ejele ngoba ngiyisiboshwa. And if my sentence is finished, iphelile term yam up ku correctional service. Therefore, okulandelayo is responsibility the social worker, the health department, not for correctional service. I don't agree with this.
I also want to disagree with this proposal because this person, he has already served his sentence, and now he or she is in a difficult stage to be released. And now why must they keep her inside a prisoner? Because even the parole board that is going to deal with this issue must look at the situation of this poor person who's sick. They must look at thoroughly, Chairperson. I don't think right now if I got sick here, sitting here, you'll keep me here. You'll take me to the nearest hospital so that I must survive. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chair, I just want to query the following. See, one reads this carefully. This is what it says. It says that whose release is certified by the correctional medical practitioner to be likely to result in his or her death or impairment of his or her health or to be a source of infection to others may be temporarily detained until his or her release is authorized by the correctional medical practitioner. My problem with this is the following, Chair. To me, the may is acceptable in this case. What bothers me is that that person may be temporarily detained until his or her release is authorized by the correctional medical practitioner. Now, on the one hand, Chair, this person has completed his or her sentence. But the person has now got an illness and there's nobody to take the person or whatever. So that person may be temporarily kept there. But then this business of someone else authorizing his or her release should then not be applicable. It should be voluntary. That person is told that, look, you have the right to go. Of course, one has to take into account whether the sort of illness a person has got can have an impact on society outside. And the person can then be advised that, look, by you going home, your family is at risk if he has a family. People in your neighborhood will be at risk. And therefore it is advisable for you to remain. But you cannot compel him unless, Chairperson, unless there is another provision in some other legislation which says that the person must be quarantined. If that happens, then the person must be quarantined in an institution that is meant for quarantined persons. So to me, Chairperson, the problem is that yes, if it is left at the discretion of the inmate, the inmate prefers to remain inside, it is one thing. But then this thing qualifies it again, that until his or her release is authorized by the correctional medical practitioner. Now that's worrisome, Chair, which means that someone must authorize it. But the person has already served the sentence. So I think, Chairperson, what we need to find out here is whether there is any other legislation in terms of which a person whose health condition is a threat to others can be detained in an institution other than a correctional facility in order to safeguard both that person and the society to which he would be released. If that is available, Chair, and I would think, even under common law, there should be such a provision, then this is not necessary, Chair. If something of that sort is not available, then we can look at how this thing should be worded. But as it is currently worded, Chairperson, to my mind, you are actually taking the liberty of a person and placing it in the hands of somebody who will decide whether that person can leave or not at a later stage. And that principle, to my mind, would not be correct, Chair. Thank you.
Chairperson, yes, Member Abrams already addressed the crux of the matter, but it seems to me, in my view, that this section is trying to strike a balance between the infringement of human rights as well as the public interest. You know, and I think it is up to the department to explain to us the justifiability of this particular section. Thanks.
Yeah, Chairperson, I think we are now taking the job of the health department. Because if we are saying that we are going to look after the people that are sick in our correctional center, actually taking the responsibility of health department. And if the department can explain to us fully, how can you keep a person that has expired his sentence in our correctional center without him saying that, no, I want to be kept because I've got this disease? Is he going to be given a chance to say that, or is he just going to be kept?
Let's ask you to respond to those things. Let me add my piece and then you'll respond to it. Over and above what everybody else has said here, I think we run the danger of converting this correctional facility, whichever one it is, into a welfare type of state. You see, my difficulty is, what you are saying to me in layman's language, Vincent is a danger if he goes back to Westbury, because he might affect the people in Westbury. Therefore, he's safer to stay in jail. My counter argument with you is that in that facility itself, we know that we do not have the capacity to quarantine people. It's not even a question, Mr. Abraham. We don't have the capacity to quarantine people. We know that. So you are then safeguarding the community in Westbury, where I come from, but you are putting at risk the community in South Sea, where I am, or whatever it is. If you're saying I'm not going out because I'm going to infect the people there, why are you then putting at risk the other members that are coming out? That's why the quarantine thing for me is the more important one. But not even quarantine within our facilities. So-and-so has finished his sentence. He must go out. South Africa Incorporated must decide, Guti, what are we doing with Vincent Smith? It shouldn't be a correctional facilities, baby. That is my take on it. Now, there might have been rationale at the time. But really, somebody would have to come to me and say to me, why must correctional services be the custodian of Vincent, who in essence is a free man? If you were the best facility in terms of quarantine and so on, it might have been all right. But you are not. You are overcrowded. We've heard that yesterday from the ministerial report. We've heard it all along that we just have an overcrowding situation in our facilities. We know we have shortages of doctors and nurses and those. We know this.
not only is he going to save the people in Gandla, but you're going to affect the people in South Sea. To me, that's how I understand it. So, from where we are standing as a committee, this thing is very problematic. It's just not workable. It's very problematic. But we're going to allow you to exhale as well, so that you go and consult on your side, but you'll understand that we will have this difficulty. Mr. South is the only one that hasn't spoken on it, unless you're covered by what people have said. Thank you very much. Oh, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's important to understand that this is not correctional services as such. It's the medical officer, a practitioner, who decides and advises us that it's at this stage not advisable. So he does it in terms of the profession's guidelines on when should somebody be quarantined. If he says somebody must stay in because of normal TB, we will be liable for this and we can be taken to court. So if he makes a decision, it would be a recommendation in order as not to be a source to infect others. Or if this person dies and we release him and his family takes us to court and says, you are at correctional services, they put you out the next day. Because also, this doesn't apply to somebody who is eligible for parole. It's not somebody who is eligible for medical parole. It's somebody who literally couldn't even qualify for medical parole because you couldn't place him out on medical parole because this talks about whose sentence has expired. So he's really sick. So what I would suggest is that we could add in here to make it clear where such person is to be kept. The problem with the Department of Health and us is, if you look at Section 12 of our Act, literally it says we're responsible for the health care, and that's where we're walking into problems currently with the Department of Health, and it's an ongoing negotiation process to get to a service-level agreement between us. Currently, if we take an inmate to a public state hospital, we do not even get treatment. We have to go to private doctors because we do not qualify currently even for the rates that you pay or what. So there's a problem with our interaction with the Department of Health, and we're responsible in terms of Section 12 of our Act for the health of our inmates. But these inmates in these instances, I'm sure, because of their health situation, will be either in the hospital section of our own facilities or then in the private hospital where we place such a person to be treated, or the public hospital. So what we could add in here, because this is an existing provision also, I must list, and it's really, everybody's got the right to freedom, but no right is ultimate. Every right could be limited in terms of the Constitution if there's reasonable and justifiable reasons. And in this instance, the reasons are linked to the person's own health, firstly, and secondly, it's linked to the protection of the society against further infection. So I think it is a balance that you strike in this provision, and if we take it out completely, let us ask ourselves what would be the effect. What would be the effect then? Firstly, find there is legislation. We will go and look at the health provisions on XDR because we do have XDR cases, and we cannot release those people into society because it's the multiple drug-resistant TB. Currently, under health legislation, those people must be quarantined. We cannot release them. So where are they being kept? I will find out those details. But we do have such cases, but I'm sure if we can tighten up the provision maybe by making it clear where such person is kept, because it's not a decision of the parole board, it's not a decision of any correctional official, it's a decision of a medical practitioner based on the legislation and the practice that guides the medical profession.
No, it's not debated. I think you guys are understanding what we're saying. It really now becomes your challenge. This side of the house is not going to accept this thing as it is. This side of the house, really, you'll have to go and talk to Nosview. This is a health problem. It's not our problem. It really is, because the medical practitioners, when Sama came here, they were quite jealous about their profession and their practitioners. I think we should put the ball where it belongs. In my own discussions yesterday with some of these guys that are doing visits, indicated to me what we are talking about here, about the, what would you call it, the abuse of correctional inmates, even in the private hospitals. That's what they were talking about. And I'm saying you don't fix it up by hiding them in correctional services. Take them to the hospital, and the hospital must sort them out. I mean, from where I'm standing, ideally this thing must be out. Ideally, once Vincent's term is over, on that day that it's over, Vincent must go home. Vincent must go home. His family can't look after him. Social welfare must look after him. His family don't want to accept him because sometimes the family would not even accept you. I'm saying this because, you know, in the hospitals when we do oversight, the hospital Helen Joseph is complaining that they have to do, I don't know how many paupers funerals, because they have these people there and their family have refused to accept them. The net effect is that that facility says to me that they can't do something to somebody that's very sick because they must pay for Vincent, whose parents have not allowed him. So I'm saying the unintended consequences of this action would be, one, we don't have facility space for somebody who must come in. We exacerbate overcrowding because we are being nice people. And I'm not saying we must not be nice people. Just from where I'm standing, I'm going to argue that this thing must be relooked at. I really am going to argue that because I know, Lorette, you want to be nice. I know, Lorette. But if the medical practitioner does this, let the medical profession deal with it. Because they can't make a decision and we suffer the consequences on the side. This is my position. We're not going to debate it, so let's just understand the context. I'm sure when we have it in closed doors, our debates will be sharpened and strengthened. But for the benefit of the department, let's allow Mr. Self, let's allow Mr. Matt, anybody else, even if you don't respond, just that you get a sense of what we are saying. But let's take Mr. Self.
Thank you, Chair. I think you've raised a very, very important point, and it really deals with who has responsibility for what in terms of interdepartmental relationships. But I would ask you that the very valid point that you're making about infectious diseases is even truer in respect of mental illness. And we still got to go back to that previous section to deal with that. Because simply because there's no bed space in a mental hospital is no reason, in my view, to detain somebody in a prison. And I was informed last night there are approximately 90 people in Polesmoor alone waiting for assessment at psychiatric hospitals. And so if your point is valid about whose responsibility is it, then it's even more so the case with mentally ill patients. And I think it's time that we have the Department of Health here at some point or another to tell us what they are doing to shoulder their responsibility rather than saying it's a correctional services matter.
Chair, yes, my argument is very straightforward. I listened to Lorette's argument about Section 12, that the Act states is their responsibility, but we have to strike distinct between an inmate and a person who's legally entitled to be released, who's no more, doesn't fall anymore within the confines of the definition of an inmate. In terms of Section 12, that is your responsibility as long as the person is an inmate. But Vincent Smith's time or period of inmate stopped the day when he has been released legally. So from there on, it can be still your responsibility to provide medical services. So I just want to clear that particular point.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you.
Chairperson, I think the department will understand our argument. You remember, Chair, that we were on a challenge of a medical parole. We want it to be there because we want that person. Ukuthi uma egula, that person must be released. Seeing that ahamba ayokulele ekhaya ashonele ekhaya. But now if we allow this act of this again, that means we are contradicting ourselves about it, the way I understand it, that now we don't know what we want as correctional things. My colleagues have covered me in terms of saying we as correctional service siyavalela umuntu until we discuss that sokuthakhulula. After that person has been released, then it's not our responsibility as correctional service. I think we need to understand like that. Even if we uyagula but nafika isikhathi sakhe sokuthi aphume sifike isikhathi sakhe sokuthi aphume. Therefore it's not my responsibility as correctional staff. We've got health department, we've got social department. If ever these departments are not working together now, I think they must start to work together, Chair. If must then a limit with a correctional service, ihamba iqinelo line ngale kwalo line akusase responsibility of correctional service, so we responsibility of social work, so we responsibility of health. That's why you've got this cluster. So let us make this cluster work effectively and not pile ourselves with a work that we see that is not our responsibility. But if ever this committee chair on this clause is not right, we need a debate on this thing, Chair. We can't agree with something that we feel that we're not comfortable about it. Thank you.
Chair, I think in addition to what Mr. Self has suggested, that we have the Department of Health here, I think we need the police here, and we also need social development. All these departments impact on the legislation that we have before us. It has consequences for each of them. Now, Chairperson, I just want to bring out a hypothetical example. Let us assume that a particular correctional facility, that the entire facility, and let's not say that it's impossible, the word impossible unfortunately is not part of my dictionary. Let's assume that the entire facility, including perhaps even some of the officials there, contracts some or other virus. I would like the department to tell us what the consequences would be and how would it address it in terms of current legislation. Are you then going to tell the Department of Health that this is a no-go area, no one else can come in here, Department of Health must take over this whole facility for as long as this virus has not been cleared? Secondly, Chair, the argument that there are MDR patients and we cannot, sufferers, and we cannot allow them to go. I think, again, we need to ask ourselves, Chairperson, is that facility the correct place for those people to get the necessary medical care? I don't know. We need to ask ourselves that question. Similarly, the same thing with mental patients, Chairperson. We have institutions specifically created to take care of mental patients. Is it correct that a person with a mental problem is to be kept in a correctional facility? It's again, Chairperson, a question of conscience on the one hand. On the other hand, we need to know where does society stand on these issues. And we are the society. We need to know this. Thank you, Chair.
Because we've ranted and raved, but I thought it was important. We're also going to allow you to rant and rave. I mean, there's no right or wrong, so that you can also assist us now. And if you feel like you want to go away and consult more, you'll go away. The principle applies that we used yesterday, that because of time frames, you'd have to come to us before we take a firm decision on our side. But when you do that, also consider this clause in terms of the Constitution and my freedom not to be deprived freedom arbitrarily or without just cause. And there's another one that talks there about there are these two clauses in the Constitution that talk about my freedom. And I know that these are not absolute rights. But when we do this, can somebody come and turn around and say, well, as many people have said here, that
the doctor takes the decision regardless of what Ndlovu says. And Ndlovu might say, I'm fine. My mother would look after me. Some practitioner says, no, from my medical experience, Wena, you're staying here for another week. So I'm saying it's those things that we want to look at, over and above the fact that just generally, as parliamentarians, we have serious challenges with the overcrowding, the lack of our own ability to look after our own people that are still in prison. We can't take the burden of Vincent who is free. I'm saying, so you can, any one of you, all of you if you want to, just exhale if you want to, but otherwise find a way of coming to convince us otherwise. Let me leave you to that.
Chair, I don't know if anybody else wants to add anything, but for me it's just also, you said the right to freedom, but I think if we look at the essence of this provision, it seems that it's intended for the protection of the inmate so that he does not die or that his health does not get impaired further, and secondly, the protection of society. Well, the protection of the person, then, Chairperson, and that's what it's intended for, and that's why what I intend to undertake is to go look at how the Department of Health deals with cases which they do not allow the person to be really to check out of the hospital, for instance, etc., and how they manage that kind of provisions. So then we can look at that. The problem is that it's I'm not even going to engage on the Department of Health's role because the committee can do that. But yeah, it's been an ongoing battle from the department side.
Thanks, Chair. Informed by the obvious sentiment of the members of the committee, I think we might have to think very carefully about a mechanism whereby if you know that Loiso's sentence is going to expire on Monday and Loiso has got an MDR or an XDR condition, that sort of a thing, and for one reason or the other, I still remain in prison, but my sentence is expiring next Monday, then it must be incumbent on us, only that, to start engaging with the health department to say, on Monday, please create space to admit Loiso, because Loiso on Monday is a free man. However, Loiso has got an XDR, so it would not be advisable for Loiso to go into society, nor would it remain valid for Loiso to remain in prison on the basis of him having this XDR condition. So what I'm saying is we may create a mechanism whereby in time we liaise with the department and say, we've got this problem, this person is going to be a free man on such and such a date, please accept him. In the event that you can't do that within the required time, you may also want to quantify very conservatively the word temporarily there by saying, for instance, within 24 hours or 48 hours, but not to say temporarily, because temporarily can be quite an elastic word. So we can look at those mechanisms just to make sure that the balance remains there, but in a more responsible fashion than the current construction of that clause otherwise suggests. But those are one's ideas. Thanks, Chair.
Chairperson.
That we've exhausted at least the discussions around that one. Okay. Subsection 3, 73.3. What does it say in layman's language? Does somebody want to interpret, or do you want me to continue interpreting it? Because had we not done it in this session, we would have missed this point earlier on. My understanding, and you'll correct me, Loretta, and anybody else, a sentenced offender must be released from a correctional center and from any form of community corrections imposed in lieu of part of a sentence of incarceration when the term of incarceration imposed has expired. You see, those two are totally contradictory. This one, he says that when his term has expired, he must be released. The one before says his term has expired, but we can keep him for, and I hear what you're saying, keep him for qualified reasons. But this one is basically saying that when my term has expired, I must release. I don't think there's an issue on that one. It was just
one is clear. Number four says, in accordance with the provisions of this chapter, a sentenced offender may be placed under correctional supervision or on day parole, or medical parole before the expiry of his or her term of incarceration. That's also clear. That says that, unless you guys want to intervene, but that one is clear, so we move on to five. Then five would be, a sentenced offender may be placed under correctional supervision or day parole or medical parole on a date determined by the Correctional Supervision and Parole Board. Is that how we're reading it? That in brackets, a prisoner must be under... does that fall out? Okay. Oh, okay. Determined by the parole board, or an offender sentenced to life incarceration on a date to be determined by the minister. Okay, and then it goes on to say, such placement is subject to the provisions of Chapter 6, and such offender accepting the conditions of placement. I think that one is clear. So it says that, no, if it doesn't, we'll get there just now. We'll get there just now. But I'm saying that one is very clear, that you placed under parole, if you are lifer, by the minister, or they said by the minister. I think that one is clear. I think you wanted to get involved from 6 onwards, because that's where you made amendments. Let's hand over to you. So, yes.
Chair, can I just propose, if you look at subsection 2 and 3, would it not be much more appropriate to place section 3 first, and then that the contents of section 2 make it 2 and 2, 3, where you first deal with incarceration post has expired, however, any sick, and then you qualify then the particular section. Doesn't it follow then much better? You know, the one is strict, the other one says, however, under these circumstances, there might be other, just a proposal.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe I will just read subsection 6A as well. It's actually A, capital A, that I want to get to, but let's deal with A first. Subject to the provisions of paragraph B, a sentenced offender, in other words, the general position is being stated for parole for everybody in A, and then we're going to have all the exceptions coming now. But the general position is as follows. Subject to the provisions of paragraph B, a sentenced offender serving a determinate sentence or cumulative sentences of more than 24 months may not be placed on day parole or parole until such sentenced offender has served either the stipulated non-parole period, or if no non-parole period was stipulated, half of the sentence. But day parole or parole must be considered whenever a sentenced offender has served 25 years of a sentence or cumulative sentences. In layman's terms, Chairperson, what this says is, if you're sentenced to a sentence of longer than 2 years, you must serve half of it. Then you can be considered for parole, unless it could be half or 25 years, whichever comes first. Because if it's a lifer, we're saying for lifers it's 25 years. Or if you have a cumulative sentence, it would be 25 years if it's a very long sentence, otherwise it's half. So that's all this provision stipulates, the general position. And now we will come to the exceptions. Then A, capital A. Now here we're proposing an amendment. Subject to the provisions of paragraph B, an offender serving a determinate sentence or cumulative sentences of not more than 24 months may not be placed on parole or day parole until such offender has served either the stipulated non-parole period, or if no non-parole period was stipulated, a quarter of the sentence. Chairperson, here we're proposing a change in the parole system. In the sense that this now, the A part regulated if you're sentenced longer than 2 years. Now we're dealing with the people sentenced shorter than 2 years. So it can be anything from 3 months, 6 months to 11 months. And currently, they would have served half of their sentence before they became eligible for placement on parole. And remember, when we place, we have no programs for these people in our centers. If you look at the other provisions of our act, we don't deal. So literally, you sit there and you wait. At least if we can place you under community corrections, we can say you go there under these conditions. You attend these programs. You do community service here. So we can actually do something with this person. So we're saying, let's change the half to a quarter. It doesn't mean the person gets off lightly because his sentence only expires at the end of the date, but at least he'll be serving, he'll be engaged in some form of programs in community corrections. Also, why I'm saying that this doesn't influence, if you look at my big table there, which was in your handouts also, why this doesn't really create a new parole system because these people have such short sentences. We're not talking, the moment this act kicks in, it will be very few people who still fall under the old act. Because it would have been half of somebody's sentence. So it will only affect a small population. It's not like bringing in a provision or new parole system that affects a whole lot of people in a long term, like people sentenced to 15 or 20 years where we have to have then different systems. So the implementation period will be quite quick. So that's why we're proposing a quarter. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to stop.
Comments on that
one? I think it's very sensible, the suggestion. In fact, you know, if we lived in an ideal world, I think there should be no such thing as a sentence of less than 24 months, because if there are no programs, why send somebody to prison anyway? I mean, those people should ordinarily be diverted straight into community corrections in any event. But in the absence of a system of that nature, I think it is in line with what we have been proposing on this committee for some time, which is to increasingly try and get as many people into community corrections as possible.
Chair. Then we come now to the B part. So now what we've stipulated for parole is we've dealt with the general position is you serve half if it's more than 2 years, and the general position if it's less than 2 years, a quarter, or then for lifers, 25 years. Now we come to other categories of parole. The first one here, a person who has been sentenced to periodical incarceration must be detained periodically, in a correctional center as prescribed by regulation. Now, here we're only changing terminology. Periodical incarceration is a term of imprisonment or incarceration that the presiding officer imposes. We cannot change.
Chairperson, the person normally serves the periodical imprisonment over a weekend. The regulations that we talk of here indicates the person must report on a Friday at a particular time, and then on a Sunday evening, typically knock off, so the person can still work during the week. So that's the...
ordered by court, so we just regulate the process. Then we're proposing deleting Roman 2 and 3 because these are not being used in practice at all anymore. Imprisonment for corrective training, may be detained in a prison for a period of 2 years and may not be placed on parole until you serve 12 months, and imprisonment for prevention of crime. None of these sentences have been imposed for the past a very long period, Chairperson. That's why... and it's been repealed in the Criminal Procedure Act, so, yeah, it's out. Yeah. It was nonsensical, Chair. Then Roman 4 is life incarceration may not be... So, again, we read, a person who has been sentenced to life incarceration may not be placed on day parole or parole until he or she has served at least 25 years of the sentence. Now, this is the general statement. So for lifers, it's 25 years, and this, of course, now is the position after 1 October 2004. We're taking out the second part because we're actually, this is another amendment we're proposing. Previously, it was only for lifers. If you've reached the age of 65 and you've already served 15 years of your sentence, we could consider you for placement on parole. We're now proposing taking it out there and then inserting a new Roman 6 down where you would see it, where we're saying we want to broaden this. We want to say not only lifers, if you're above 65 and have served 15 years, say, for instance, you've been sentenced to 40 years imprisonment and it's not a life sentence. So 40 years, your half would come up at 20 years only. But you're also a very elderly person, so we're broadening the category. Again, we do not think this will have a major impact because there's not many people falling in this category who would benefit from this. So it won't have a major impact on the parole system, but we are making it more advantageous to people who fall within this category. Person he used to qualify, yes, and he will now still qualify. That we're just broadening it to other elderly people who have been sentenced to very long terms. And in any case, it's for consideration for parole. It's no guarantee parole will be granted. So.
I'm 50 years old, and I commit murder. I get life. 15 years later, I will be 65 years old. No, I've committed life. 15 years later, I'm 65. I then am eligible to go before the parole board. That's what it means in layman's language. I think it is important because these things come to us every day. And committee must then be able to say it makes sense. So I'm just playing devil's advocate here. Gucci, me right now, I'm 50. If I kill somebody today, 15 years later, I could come out, regardless of whether they not come out, eligible for parole. Because the judge would have sentenced me to life, but by then I'll be 65 and one day, and according to the law, I would be able then to go and say, I've now served 15 years, I'm 65 years old, can I appear before the parole board? That's what it means in layman's language. So that we understand it, we allow them an opportunity to hear what our sentiments are, but we will discuss it amongst ourselves. But that's what it really means in layman's language. Yes, sir.
Can I ask the question, Jefferson? What does 65 mean? Does it mean that you cannot commit any murder after 65? What does it mean? Because I'm trying to understand the way you are explaining it. If you are 65, let's say you are 66 tomorrow, then you commit murder, what will happen? You see, that's my problem. That's my problem. Because you have already killed my brother. How can you then say, you have sent us to life imprisonment, you have to go for 25. It doesn't matter to me that you are 65 or not. I'm trying to grab what 65 years mean.
Related to this, what I would like to know is the current provision is that after 15 years of incarceration, you are eligible to apply for parole.
If you're over 65,
that's the current situation. No, Chairperson, wait a minute. There's 25 and 65 buggers you around. At the moment, even if you are under 65, you can apply for parole after 15 years. Am I correct? Or
no.
No, you can't. It must be 25 years, but not at 15. Now, Chairperson, does this now say that only if you are 65 years and over may you apply for parole after having served 15 years? That's a new provision. Okay. Thank you, Chair.
I know that there was an old one before that said the same thing as well. What the department is trying to do is to regulate it, to say, from now going forward. Let's not talk about what's the current position or whatever. From now going forward, if I'm over 65, I've served 15 years, regardless.
regardless of what the crime was. No, you're saying for life. Not only for life, no, because this other one is introducing whatever else. It's saying, if I've served 15 years, if I've served 15 years, we're talking about this one as it stands, if we agree to this, if I'm over 65, I've already served 15 years. Regardless of the crime, I am eligible to go before the parole board. Whether I'm a lifer or whatever, that's what it is. Not regardless of the sentence, maybe should be the correct one. Regardless of the sentence, yes. Once I'm 65 and I've served 15 years, I'm eligible to go before the parole. Whether they give me parole is a different story, but I'm eligible to go before the parole board, is what you are saying. Others are saying, what is the magic about 65? But let's hear Mr. Sell, and then we'll allow you to continue.
Now, I was really trying to help my colleague, Mr. Abram, to understand it. But, I mean, there's a practical illustration of it at the moment. The offender's name is Clive Darby Lewis, and he committed murder, and he's now over 65 years old. He served 16 years. He's now eligible for parole. Eligible to appear before the parole board. But as I understand the department, what they're now saying, and I think you summarized it correctly, is that notwithstanding any other offender who's over 65, who served a minimum of 15 years for any offence, those people are now also eligible for consideration for parole, as I understand it.
Chairperson, what we're saying in essence is, since this was the existing position is that if you were sentenced to life for having committed whatever heinous crime, currently you could benefit from this provision. So we said we also have other elderly people in our centres who've committed lesser offences because the court didn't see the necessity to sentence them to life. Why can't they benefit from it? So we're trying to open it up to them. The 65, I asked Mr. Paxton because I wasn't around when they decided on that number. It's not a magical number, but it was linked to the age of retirement and the ailments we then see amongst, because this is it's a provision that is linked to the fact that the person is an elderly person in our centres, and that's why we even have now other provisions we're bringing in for the elderly in the remand detainee. So it's linked to the ailments that come with the age, and it's worsened, of course, for the conditions in a correctional facility. But that's the essence of what we're...
We're understanding it correctly. We can't fight with them now. If we want to change it, in our own indoor meeting, we'll change it. This is just to understand the clause, so that we understand it when we go back to our caucuses. If I'm 65 years old, Bob, regardless of the crime I've committed, regardless of the sentence that I've been sentenced to, I am eligible to appear before the parole board. Whether they give me parole is a different story. I'm eligible to appear before the parole board. Now, that is what is being proposed. We must go and ask it amongst our family, friends, and everybody else and influence each other. If we want to change it to 85, we will do so when we come and see them. If we want to make it 35, we will do so if we will come and see them. But as it stands now, it says you've served 15 years, you're 65 years plus one day, you should be eligible to go before the parole board. Whether you're a life sentencer or you've still got 10 years before you've reached 50% of your time. And what we would have to go and research is how many people is this going to affect? Because once it comes into practice, how many people that have not served 50 years, 50% of their time, will then be eligible to appear before the parole board? Because as Loretta is saying, it's now not only life, but it's opening it up to everybody else. So there could be somebody that was sentenced to 60 years when he was 40, and he would have only come out after 50%, which would have been 30 years plus he's 40 when he's about 70, roughly. He would have been eligible for parole. Now he'll be eligible for parole when he's 65. That's what it means. So members must go and apply their minds, and then we will make whatever amendments. But at least we understand what the intention is. Thanks, Lorette. Move on.
Chair, can maybe just say we will look on our system if we can track numbers as to who might fall in this category. Yes. So we will try and gather that information. Chairperson, then we come to see a person who has been declared a habitual criminal may be detained in a correctional center for a period of 15 years and may not be placed on parole, on day parole or parole until after a period of at least 7 years. Again, this is just to treat habitual criminals separately. There are links to the discussion yesterday where previously habitual criminals, there was no time period linked to them. So this is the existing provision. We're just changing terminology and adding in to make it clear that the person can also be placed on death parole. That's all we're doing. But to explain in layman's terms the position, why they don't just fall under the general half population, it's because they're a category that's treated separately in the Criminal Procedure Act. So that's why we say it's 15 years as determined by the Constitutional Court and half was 7. But it's the existing position. So they're being treated like the others actually who are sentenced to long terms. It's half, but we just stipulated separately. But we changed with terminology, really. Chairperson, then D. This is a new provision we're putting in. And, yeah, a person who has been declared a dangerous criminal in terms of Section 286A of the Criminal Procedure Act must be referred back to court in accordance with Section 75(1)(b) of this Act within 7 days after the period as determined by the court or 25 years, whichever is the shortest, has been served. Now here, let me explain why we're putting this in here. Currently it's being regulated by the Criminal Procedure Act, but since I've explained that this is the provision in the Principal Act where everything relating to parole should be, so we've decided we're putting habitual criminals separately. Let's put in dangerous criminals as well, because we do not stipulate these provisions. It's regulated by the Criminal Procedure Act. We just enforce them. So in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, if you've been declared a dangerous criminal, it's actually an indefinite period that you've been sentenced to, because it's our psychopath provision in South Africa. So if the court decides, and that the court only gets to that decision after a whole analysis by a psychologist, everything, and then basically the court says you're sentenced to an indefinite period or 25 years, whichever is the shortest, and you're brought back to court. It's not, we don't play any role in deciding whether you can be released or any. It's again a court decision. The court will either on 25 years or whatever date they've stipulated say, well, now we can place you on, we can sentence you to 5 years and then, or we can say immediate release. It's up to the court. But all we're doing here is we're just incorporating it here to have all the provisions in one place. But I just wanted for background for members to explain how dangerous criminals work.
Understanding it?
I'm afraid I'm a little less clear, and that it really what concerns me is of the period determined by the court. But I understood that many of these people are indeterminate sentences. So that's the first issue. The second issue relates to in accordance with 75(1)(b), which relates to the powers, functions, and duties of parole boards. So presumably what then in practical terms happens is this psychopath who served either the court sentence or 25 years, whichever is shorter, then appears before a parole board. The parole board then makes certain recommendations about placement. The offender then appears in court, and then the court accepts the recommendation of the parole board or not, as the case might be. That's, as I understand it, if you unpack the 75(1)(b) part of it.
Is there a role for the parole board in this or the court? How are they just the court in the subject of the 75(1)(b)? The question is, after he served his 35 years, which role play a function? The court or the parole board or the parole board?
Chairperson, Chairperson, in terms of Section 286B, it says the court which declares a person a dangerous criminal shall sentence such person to undergo imprisonment for an indefinite period and direct that such person be brought before the court on the expiration of a period determined by it, which shall not exceed the jurisdiction of the court. A person sentenced under subsection 1 to undergo imprisonment for an indefinite period shall, notwithstanding the provisions of subsection 1B, but subject to the provisions of subsection 3, within 7 days after the expiration of the period contemplated in subsection 1D, be brought before the court which sentenced him, in order to enable such court to reconsider the said sentence, provided that in the absence of the judicial officer whose sentence he can appear in front of another court, the commissioner may, if he is of the opinion that owing to practical or other this is now our national commissioner, that is of the opinion that owing to practical or other considerations, it is desirable that a court other than the court which sentenced the person should reconsider such sentence after the expiration of the period, with the concurrence of the Attorney General in this jurisdiction, can apply to the register of the court. I'm just trying to get to... In 7 we've made a number of amendments, and most of them are to clarify the current position in in 7 what we're doing is we've removed 7. Let's just read from the beginning. A person sentenced to incarceration under section 2761I of the Criminal Procedure Act must serve at least 1/6 of his or her sentence before being considered for placement under correctional supervision, unless the court is directed otherwise. Then B, a person sentenced to incarceration for a period not exceeding 5 years as an alternative to a fine under section 287(4A) of the Criminal Procedure Act may be considered for placement under correctional supervision by the National Commissioner or the Correctional Supervision and Parole Board as soon as possible after the admission to a correctional center, subject to the confirmation of suitable support system, unless the court is directed otherwise. Yes, Chair. From the Criminal Procedure Act. One I reads, subject to the provisions of this Act, the Criminal Procedure Act, and any other law, and of the common law, the following sentences may be passed upon a person convicted of an offence. Namely, imprisonment from which such person may be placed under correctional supervision and his discretion by the commissioner. These are the people sentenced to less than 5 years, and that's where they can be placed under correctional supervision by the commissioner.
Yep.
Sure. But this is a different type of sentence. This is a sentence where the court gives the commissioner the option from the beginning, in terms of this provision, to place somebody under correctional supervision and parole. So the commissioner can do it even there's no other provision. The court literally says to the commissioner, it's almost like it's having a suspended sentence for 5 years, and you can be placed under correctional supervision from the outset. So the decision has been always, if you look at the table that we've got, that it's always been 1/6 of the sentence.
I hear what you said.
Yes.
So the court says to the commissioner, as far as we're concerned, Vincent can go under supervision immediately. The commissioner then turns around and says, I disagree with the court, you're supposed to have 1/6 of the family. That's what you say. And I'm saying, if that's what you're saying, I think that because of the kind of circumstances you have, the commissioner should just agree with it.
We must distinguish the less than 24-month sentence where the person can be considered after half of the sentence would be direct imprisonment, whereas this 2761I would be the commissioner giving the commissioner the option where the sentence is less than 5 years to put the person under correctional supervision. But normally, before you put the person under correctional supervision, you have to assess the person and in terms of support systems, etc., in the community. So that's basically the reason for that particular period before the person can be considered for placement under correctional supervision. As I said, there's also another provision where the court could have put the person directly under correctional supervision, where the court would then be provided with the necessary social work reports, probation officer reports. But in this case, the court said, correctional service assessed this person. I think the person should at least serve some time, and therefore, thereafter, in the discretion of the commission, you can put that person under correctional supervision.
Okay. How practically then? To 5 years under this condition. Everybody has been sentenced to 5 years. Should be now appearing before the parole board after they've served 1/6 of their time, we say. So all those guys, if they understand this thing now, could come to us and say, well, can I go before the parole board tomorrow? The question that I'm asking is, currently the parole board sends so many people back saying, go back for more profiling, go back for more this and more that. I'm just asking, is this thing practical? Are we opening doors to another Leo Corp? You know that Leo Corp, every day we get letters from Leo Corp saying, I've served my third, I've served my quarter, I've served my whatever. The parole board is sending me away because they don't have a psychiatric report or don't have this report. I think we're trying to tighten that up. There's an opportunity to tighten that up. The question that I'm asking is this thing, if it's in or out, what difference does it make? I'm just asking the question. If it's another category that says 1/6, I personally
seriously. For me, it's either 50% or nothing, or one quarter or nothing. Here we're saying 1/6. Why didn't you say 50% for this person? Why can't we do that?
Chairperson, you may come back at that the case load, but what I can say is just in these cases, the parole board is not involved. It's the commissioner, and that the authority has been delegated to the level, if I'm correct, to area commissioners level. So it's not as if we have to convene a parole board, and the caseload is at another level. But as to what the caseload is, I don't know. So we'll have to come back to you.
Okay. No, let us, I mean, we'll go and apply our mind ourselves just that we understand it. The department is saying that if I'm sentenced to less than 5 years under this, whatever it might say in the correctional, I mean the Criminal Procedures Act, could go and ask the area commissioner to be put on parole. This is not the parole board or anybody, the area commissioner. I have never heard of one of these things happening, quite honestly. I've never heard of it. Maybe it has happened, but I've never heard of any area commissioner having said, no, it's fine, Vincent can go on parole. But it's fine that it's there. But that's what it's saying. It's saying after 1/6, then we'll have to understand. Maybe you'll help us if you can give us the categories of crimes that we're talking about there. That says these are the categories of crime. Served 1/6, you can go and ask the area commissioner to consider you for parole. That's what it's saying.
Chairperson, yeah, it's for correctional supervision. Coming
for correctional supervision.
Parole,
in
yeah.
Correctional supervision means what? It means I go and wash tractors or go and clean toilets and so on, isn't it? That's correctional supervision. What is correctional supervision?
Refer to as a probation or not as a parolee in terms of all the, yeah, because even in terms, Chairperson, to come to your question of why not 50% for these people, it's because these people are actually falling in a category where the court said you do not need direct incarceration from the outset. If the commissioner can confirm that you've got a address that can be confirmed that you can engage in XYZ programs, it's within the commissioner's discretion to place you out as soon as he can. And in our practice, it's taken us a sixth that period. That's why they've had the sixth of the sentence to get everything in order. But it's less than 50% definitely, because the court has said in this instance specifically, it's not direct imprisonment of 10 months. It's a sentence, but you can be placed under correctional supervision. So the idea is it could be implemented very quickly. And it does actually happen a lot in practice. That's why if you walk in, you would... People talk about 2761Is, and it's persons falling within that category.
Just to understand this thing, I'm sorry, you'll come in, Baba. So if the court does that today, now, they put me in the van and they take me to Sun City, and I'm then granted an opportunity to prove to them that I've got an address, that I'll find a job and those type of things, whilst I'm in the cell. I can prove that, I take it to some official there, and he signs something and he releases me and he says, from today onwards, you're going to go and watch the fire brigade check in Brixton. That's how it will work in practice. My question is, at the time of appearing before the magistrate, shouldn't we be saying, Vincent, go and prove to the magistrate, because I know it happens in practice, that you go and prove to the magistrate or you come with a psychiatrist, whatever report to the magistrate, and then they say, okay, fine, we're sentencing you to 176 hours. Immediately. You go and serve your 176 hours, and when your 176 hours are over, you're a free man. And if you commit something in between, you might have those consequences. What I'm scared of is if you send Vincent to Sun City for that week or 2 weeks, whilst you are proving his record and so on, one, he might not have people close by that would do that. But secondly, Vincent is going to be incarcerated with all these bad elements there. Are you saying this 1/6 is not enough time for Vincent to be influenced, to become a gangster, or even to sacrifice his 1/6? Because when you send somebody to Sun City now, in Joburg, 24 hours is enough time to make me kill somebody in that awaiting child suffer. We know that. We know that these things happen. But you're sending somebody there now, he goes in there, he's got a week in which to prove himself, but if he can go in there now, I don't think you need more than 2 days to become corrupted. So we're taking a vulnerable person, and I'm just talking about the practicality, I'm talking about the rehabilitation. My problem to the committee as opposed to saying, let's get them out as soon as possible and lock them in the last resort. But this one is basically saying, go inside, you've got 2 weeks, and then we can let you out. In 2 weeks, I'll kill somebody in there under the current circumstances. Or in 2 weeks, I'll be made a gangster under the current circumstances. I just think this should be looked at. I understand the period to prove that somebody is stable or can have a stable job, but surely we must find a better way of doing it, Luis. Rather than having him go and sit in a cell with 20 other guys, I'm sure there should be a better way of doing it. If our intention is rehabilitation, 2 weeks for me in a cell is enough to drive me crazy or commit suicide. So you understand where we're coming from. It's just that if somebody can straight from the magistrate's court go out, but then still go and watch the kumbis or whatever, it's better than saying to him, go inside there for 2 weeks and then we'll let you out and do it. I just think you guys must be more creative on that.
Chair, yes. If I look at this provision, it seems to me that this is only the implementation of the Criminal Procedures Act as it stands, and that they don't have a choice as to implement what the Criminal Procedure Act make provision for. Left it to the discretion of the magistrate to impose such a sentence. They are the recipients of that particular convicted person, and they have to accommodate and deal with that particular individual in terms of this act. And that is actually what, in my view, you can't actually reject the thing because it's on the statute books. We need an amendment in the Criminal Procedure Act to alleviate the burden on correctional services. The way I see it, maybe I'm wrong.
Thank you, Chairperson.
This provision, I think that it was just like that. It's not a new thing. But Chair, when we go to oversight, you'll find that there's no implementation in terms of this. You'll find an inmate that is telling you that is qualifying for this provision, but the head of the prison doesn't know about this. He's keeping this person. I remember last at a Johannesburg prison where with our former chairperson, Bloom, we have taken out maybe about 4 inmates that qualify on this provision. But our center is not implementing it. For me, Chair, this is not new. It's good, but the only thing, implementation doesn't happen. That's my problem about this. Thank you.
You see, I have a problem, Chairperson, that the department don't communicate in these matters. What I heard Max is saying is that they are the recipients of the Criminal Justice Act. But my problem is that if they are the last resort to this act and they are the burden of taking what the Criminal Justice is saying to them, how then can we say they should be looked at? Because the cluster, therefore, should look at it correctly. Because if we have a problem, and the problem does not affect them, it affects another department, then how can we assist them to look at it? Because that's a problem that we're finding ourselves. I think in layman's language, the way you're explaining it, I think it's up to them to make sure that if they talk to Justice Department about the Criminal Justice Act and look at it properly, how did this implementation take place? Maybe it will assist us, because we are in the squandles to say to them they must look at it, but they are just a recipient of what is happening at the end, they are at the tail of the situation.
Carol just wants to explain something as well. If you, it's unfortunate, I will definitely make copies available of Section 276 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which is basically the section that deals with all the sentencing options that a court has, well, the ones that doesn't fall within its inherent jurisdiction. But the one just before I, that we're dealing now with, is the court can sentence somebody to direct correctional supervision. But now it comes in I and it says imprisonment from which such a person may be placed under correction. So the court intends this person to first serve a bit and then may be placed under correctional. Otherwise, it would have told the commissioner, I send him to you, you verify, and then place him immediately. So that is the issue, I think, where we come with the six. The six is the shortest term that we've determined as part of the cluster for the bill to say, because otherwise the court would have placed the person immediately on correctional supervision under H. But now it says imprisonment from which such a person may be placed under correctional supervision. So I think that is also part of the problem. It comes back to what the members have been saying. We implement what comes from the correctional, from the Criminal Procedure Act, but the court definitely wanted this person to spend some time. And
Loretto, we're going to ask you guys to give us a small booklet on this Section 73. Because if there's anything that we get calls for, is on the parole issue. And I don't even think inmates understand it. So the more simple it is, the better. Because we're going to insist that you give us something, because they're entitled to it. To give us something, and as you go into prison, into incarceration, you should be given this book to say, this is it, this is what you can qualify for, because we are inundated with calls on a Saturday and a Sunday. So the simpler we make it here, the simpler is your job going to be in 6 months' time. We are warning you already that we're going to ask you to do that. So we're trying to simplify it for you, for us, for South Africa generally. But Mr. Self, and then you can respond to that.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps when she responds, it might be useful to know why we can't, in this section, have the same wording as the proposed amendment over the page, which basically says, shall be placed, considered for placement under correctional supervision as soon as possible after admission to a correctional center, subject to the confirmation of a suitable support system, unless the court is directed otherwise. I think that's what you're trying to get at. So why a sixth in this case, and not that formulation over the page?
Chairperson, if I may, because that's again another provision coming from the Criminal Procedure Act that deals with the position when we have, when we receive somebody sentenced in terms of Section 287(4A), and I would read that out to the committee now as the next provision, if I should continue then, because it's a different scenario. It's, the problem, it comes down for me, unfortunately, to the fact that if you're sentenced under I, it says imprisonment from which a person may be placed in correction. It's not as soon as possible. So if I now come to the wording of, if we go to the wording of 2874 A, which is what the what Mr. Self was referring to now as the direct, if I can read that to the committee, it says, unless the court which has imposed a period of imprisonment as an alternative to a fine has directed otherwise, the commissioner or a parole board may, in his or its discretion, at the commencement of the alternative punishment or at any point thereafter, if it does not exceed 5 years, act as if the person were sentenced to imprisonment as referred to in Section 2761I, which is the position we just described, or apply in accordance with the provisions of Section 276A3, that's the conversion provision, for the sentence to be reconsidered by the court AQ, and thereupon the provisions of Section 276A3 shall apply mutatis mutandis to such a case. So this is a different scenario, and maybe Carl will add on to this.
You've got basically four situations in which correctional supervision may be imposed. Firstly, the court may impose of a less serious offence directly correctional supervision. The second one, the 271I case, the commissioner, it's a sentence of less than 5 years. So it's direct imprisonment, less than 5 years. The third situation that we'll come to, where we, in the second one, we've proposed the 1/6 before consideration. In the third one, which we'll come to, we propose a quarter of the sentence. But then the court would have imposed a sentence of longer than 5 years, and the person may be considered at a quarter with not more than 5 years in the future. And the fourth one would be this one, and the emphasis here is the court imposed a fine. The person couldn't pay the fine and therefore serving a sentence at the moment. Therefore, immediate consideration, because the court anyway wanted this person out in the community by imposing a fine as an alternative to bail. So that would be the four situations in which you look at the correctional supervision.
What I wanted to add, actually, before this provision came up, is that we do have a booklet currently for inmates where this is put in layman's terms and which would be made available to the committee when we appear next week. There is a handout that explains the role for inmates.
Yeah, no, it's fine. What is the intention of parole? What is our intention of parole? What is our intention? Is it an alternative to incarceration? Is it about reintegration to society? I'm just trying to understand, when we said this thing called parole, what was our intention? Why do we want people on parole and not serve their full sentence? What is the ultimate goal? Is it because we want to lessen our facilities? What is it about? Because if it is about rehabilitation and so on, you know, I really think that we need to move away from incarceration. I really think we need to move away from incarceration to something else. Now, a sixth, a quarter, a third, for somebody that doesn't need to be there in the first instance or can pay back to society without having to go in there, for me is the first price. And I'm sure we're going to argue this amongst ourselves when we go along there. But the second point I want to make is that really it is ideal. You know, when you had come to the 15 years and 65 and the 50%, I thought we could live with that because it's two simple ones. But so many other categories, it's just making my life difficult. I'm not sure how you guys feel, but you need to understand our sentiment that it's really, 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 the simpler the better for us. The simpler the better. He must be in because he's done something. After half his time, he must go out. He sentence is found guilty. We don't think it's a big enough crime for whatever. He doesn't serve there. Let's find alternative sentences. Because sometimes when you guys come and you talk about the review of the criminal justice system or whatever, we get told that judges are reluctant to send people out directly. But I think sometimes we also help them by doing this. If you put the pressure, as you're saying, Bob, to these guys, I say, but why 1/5 send him out immediately or repeal 276I or whatever the case? Maybe it's going to move us in that direction. I just have lots of difficulty with people serving sentences for 1 month, 4 months, 6 months, and that type of thing. I just have difficulty with that. But Lorette, if you want to say something, it's fine. Otherwise, you're really in our hands. That's basically what we're saying. We are the ultimate decision makers. And we will make the law according to what makes us happy. You accept and understand our difficulties, you'll have an opportunity to come and lobby us or to come and convince us. But we're not duty-bound to accept it as you've given it to us. That's why we're having this clause-by-clause argument. So you'll go back to your principals, and they must understand our frustrations. We will talk amongst ourselves, and we will pronounce on it. But it's important that we have this type of thing. Just from where I'm standing, the less we have of this, the better for me. But you are allowed to respond and you can move on.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe just to say that we must just be careful in looking at new periods, that we do not create this new parole system, because that's going to be a fourth system then for parole boards to implement, because currently they work in terms of these periods. We're not amending the periods. We've just changed the wording around to be more clear, actually. But the problem is that we've got these different categories of inmates, and if we say now the guy who didn't pay his fine must also fall under the half category, we're actually really prejudicing him because he should not be in our center at all. That's why this B provision currently reads as soon as possible after admission to a correctional center. So him we're trying to deal with immediately. But then we do have, and that's unfortunate now, that we've got these different sentences that we have to match with different parole periods. So unfortunately it is a reality where you now have the person that's falling within the other categories of correctional supervision, as Mr. Paxton explained. So I know it's overwhelming to look at it like this, but in practice it's been applied like this. And if we go and amend the time periods, we must just be clear why we're amending the time periods and that we can actually deliver to it and that we don't take away from what the sentencing court, because what will happen is if the sentencing court becomes aware that we're now saying for that provision of I, for instance, where it's imprisonment and then the option for the commissioner to put somebody on correctional supervision, and they know, well, it's now going to be less than a six, even, say, for instance, as soon as possible, the court's not going to sentence anybody anymore in terms of that provision. We've seen it happening in other provisions where we've said, well, under 24 months, you can have come out at a quarter. Some courts have gone the other way and now sentence people to 25 months, just so that person sits for a half. So we must look at the system and the impact it has on the magistrate, because we can see on our side, well, we want this category like this, but the courts can decide, well, my sentence has no impact then because the person will immediately be on the street, so I'm going for a harsher sentence, which is within the discretion of the court. So it's a balancing act between us and all the role players, but I hear the committee on this. I was now at C, Chairperson. C, we're repealing the wording there because in practice this situation is already explained in Section 39 of the Act, which deals with consecutive sentences. So we're repealing the current wording there, and we're then rather dealing with, you would see that in B we're dealing with the position for 287-4A, which I've read out, and we're dealing then in C with 287-4B, which is the position that Mr. Paxton has explained. This is the position where this is, the first one is the fine, and the second one is where it's longer than 5 years. Yeah, so it's the longer than, so the first position in seven that we've had was the one where it's placement on a six, then we had as soon as possible for the fine, and now we have and now the longer than 5 years is the quarter that you can be considered. And then in D, Chairperson, a person sentenced to incarceration for a definite period in terms of Section, and then D is a different position now altogether, because 2761B is a determinate sentence. It's just a plain determinate sentence. It says a person sentenced to incarceration for a definite period in terms of Section 2761B of the Criminal Procedure Act may not be placed under correctional supervision unless such sentence has been converted into correctional supervision in accordance with Section 27683 of the Criminal Procedure Act. 276A3, I will also deal with that, Chairperson, is again where we can refer certain categories of inmates back to the court for a conversion of their, they've been sentenced to a direct period, with the option that they can be referred back to the court for conversion into correctional supervision. And 3A reads as follows: where a person has been sentenced by a court to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years, or exceeding 5 years, but his date of release in terms of the provisions of our Act and the regulations made thereunder is not more than 5 years in the future, and such person has already been admitted to a prison, the Commissioner or Parole Board may, if he or it is of the opinion that such a person is fit to be subjected to correctional supervision, apply to the clerk or register of the court so that the person can appear before the court again in order to reconsider the said sentence. It is used in practice, Chairperson. Inmates themselves actually initiate it, but as will become clear from the report of the task team, it's not utilized enough because this onus is on correctional services to go this route, and it's not being utilized enough in practice. But this option was created for in the Criminal Procedure Act. Chairperson, and then we've inserted here as a result of the Price case. I've also provided copies of the Price case, which is a Supreme Court of Appeal case, to the committee. This deals with conversion of sentence, and it reads as follows: a person sentenced to incarceration for a definite period under Section 2761B of the Criminal Procedure Act may be referred to a court in accordance with Section 276A3A, that is now the conversion provision of that act, if the offender has completed at least a quarter of the effective sentence and the remainder of the sentence until sentence expiry date does not exceed 5 years.
I hear what you're saying. You know, this 276, if it is a stumbling block in our life, then we need to look at it. We really have, because we're the recipients of 276 with everything else. This one says, if I've got a definite period, if the offender has completed at least a quarter of that definite period, and the remainder is less than 5 years, He can apply for a conversion. That's what we're saying, isn't it? If the remainder is less than 5 years, it's 4 years, he served more than a quarter. So these are people that serve what type of sentence? 12, 13-year type of sentences. What type of category of years are these people serving? So that we just understand in our own head, when we go out, we must be able to say people that are serving 13 years or whatever the figure might be, After serving, or if they've got 5 years left, but they've served more than a quarter, can be taken out and converted. You know, is there more or less a cutoff that these are the people that normally serve between 10 and 15 years or whatever? It's hell of a complicated, this thing. This parole that you guys are, that is there, not you guys are bringing, but that's there. It's hell of a complicated, and I think that is why we're having so many problems. One day I'm going to talk to you guys and tell you what people are whispering in our ears. That because of the complication, correctional services run away and don't do any of these things. That's why your case loads are the way they are. That's why just before Vincent is on parole, you transfer him somewhere else. Because officials are overwhelmed in trying to interpret this thing. So what's the best thing to do is to, as far as possible, try and defer his parole system. It's what's happening. It's what we're getting from people out there. And now I can understand why people are doing this type of thing, because it's just too complicated. So before I even consider taking him to the parole board, I make it as difficult. In other words, we're making it as difficult as possible. Not because we don't like the individual, but because it's so complicated to implement. And we can't be, I can't be part of further concretizing that type of thing. I'm telling you, we cannot be part of it. So that's why I'm saying on another day we're going to have a debate. My fear just is once we rubber stamp this thing, it makes it very difficult to undo it in the future. But the unintended consequences are that people get transferred, people get told to go and do profiling, takes them another 2 years to all we're doing is just denying people to come before the parole board because we don't understand it ourselves. That's what we are doing. And I'm saying, Mr. Self, that some of these things, I understand why it's so difficult for people to go on parole. I just understand it. And I think we will have to apply our mind. And that's why I asked the question initially, what is the intention of the parole system? What is the intention of the parole system? Because the intention is one thing, if we don't apply it, it's something else. But, yeah, exhale, guys. It's going to be a very difficult exercise, this one. Let's take Mr. Self and then take Munir Abraham.
Thank you, Chair. In reply, I wondered whether one further aspect of clarification could be given. And that is really, I heard right at the beginning of the section when we were talking about it, that we were moving away from parole being determined from by B orders, and instead they were going to be codified in the Act, which is correct. But I suspect that there are some things that are contained in B orders that affect the way that the parole board determines or hears the cases. So, for example, if one has participated in an escape or something like that, I just want to be very, very clear that there is nothing contained in the B orders that would affect in any way the determination of sentences and the calculation of a period before which time that person can appear before a parole board. Because I don't want us to go through this exercise and then find that there's an additional complication that we know nothing about.
Chairperson, my problem is that the amendments that are being brought in, the English is not consequential. It reads very badly. And here we must remember, Chairperson, that the overwhelming majority of the officials in the department that must read this law and help to implement it. I mean, if I'm at sixes and sevens, I can expect everyone else to be tens and twelves. So, Chairperson, this English is not user-friendly. They must refine this. They must streamline it. You don't need all these long, polluted words. It can be done in a much more concise way. Then, Chairperson, I would like to find out that after this legislation was prepared by the department, have they had a party that knows constitutional law that has looked at this? And whether they have given you the stamp of approval that the legislation is prepared is constitutional. Because I've already heard, Chairperson, that on the basis of the current legislation, without amendments, if it were to be passed as it is, that you will be facing constitutional challenges. And I just want to remind you, Chairperson, I've learned in the past that when you ask questions like these, you are told that no, but the state law advisors have approved of the legislation, it's 100%. The next thing, Chairperson, you have court challenges mounted, and of course, as a result of that, that legislation is declared unconstitutional, and we are back to square one. And in that whole process, Chairperson, years go by. So what I'm asking, Chairperson, firstly, that you do this in a simplified form. These clauses must read simply. It must be understood. Even if you have one-line clauses, and there's a hell of a lot of sub-clauses or sub-sentences, let it be something that the layperson can understand. Not everybody, and including parolees or possible parolees or future parolees or inmates, their families are in a position to go and see a lawyer. Very simple to say that, yes, you have access to the courts. Access to the courts do not come cheap. You need to have money. A majority of our people that find themselves in these situations do not have that. So, Chair, this is my plea. That it be simple, and I would like to see a certification from the department that they have this by an outside party, not the drafters hereof, who certify that the bill as presented before us is, in terms of the Constitution, constitutional. As I have grave doubts, Chairperson, about its constitutionality, if one looks at some of the provisions here. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, to start with the issue of constitutionality, we did not change any substantive provisions here that were not there except for the quarter issue that I've highlighted earlier and the 65 issue. Everything else here, we've actually attempted to put it in layman's language. The problem is we have to refer back to the Criminal Procedure Act, and I think that's what makes the difficulty in reading it. But that's why we have a handout to inmates which explains the parole procedures in layman's terms, and we will bring the handout to the committee, because in terms of the Act, if we do not refer back to the Criminal Procedure Act, we will have to then incorporate all, and it will become even more confused to read it if you interpret and have to include the complete wording of Section 2874A, for instance, instead of just referring thereto. But then coming to the issue of constitutionality, we've dealt with the bill in terms of the Constitution. Constitution says that in order to introduce a bill into Parliament, it must be certified by the state law advisors as being in accordance with the Constitution. That is the provision for all bills introduced into Parliament, and we followed that. There's no request for us, or there's no onus on us to take it to any other body. That's why the Constitution created the system that it goes through the state law advisor, and the state law advisor is here today. They certified independently as being in accordance with the provisions of the Constitution. Otherwise, they could not have introduced it into, we could not have introduced it into Parliament without a different certificate that says we differ with, but we didn't go there in accordance with us. The issue of you could never say that inmates always, when it deals with their freedom, they will always challenge whichever provision. And I can just say that we've not been found to be. The Act was recently subjected to a constitutional court challenge, and in Fonfiren, it didn't find any of the provisions of the Act unconstitutional. It could just read in a different application thereof to keep it constitutional, and that was to do with life first in that instance. So not even, not the wording of the Act itself. But you can never say when somebody would launch a challenge, but we've done everything that we could do to determine that it's constitutionally certified before introduction. Then as to the issue of the escapes Mr. Self raised, as Mr. Paxton tried to explain, there was that position where they sent out a circular to say for escapes, the department now decides, even though it's not in the Act, 80%. The court then said, you can't. This is ultra vires. The Act is where the law is laid down in this regard. You can only put in practice that whatever you have in the B order, it can be guidelines, but it cannot, no parole board can in terms of that decide, now if you've got to escape, it should be 80%. If there's any parole board currently which still acts, because unfortunately I must say some parole boards still act in terms of orders that have been repealed, even though we print across it repealed, they still implement it, then that matter must be taken on review immediately, because it shouldn't be the case at all. And the inmate could be taken on review by the body created in the bill, in the Act, or taken to court, because there's no provision. If it's not stipulated in here, it's not a parole period provision, and that's what the court said to us as well. So any old circulars have been repealed through the process. If it's still standing there, then it shouldn't be implemented at all. Thank you, Chair.
So anybody that's being denied because he hasn't served 4/5 of his time or those figures, those things are all now illegal. That's what I'm saying. It's not in here, therefore it holds no water. All right? Because your parole boards in Kimberley and Bloemfontein are detaining people because of that act. I mean, because of that, because the first time I heard of not serving 4/5 of the time, and that maybe it was, maybe it's legal as we speak now, but once the thing is passed, it will no longer be legal. I suggest that you tell the parole boards these days, because we've got those type of cases. Certainly in the Bloemfontein, Kimberley area. For some reason, people are not being even considered because they haven't served 4/5. And I suspect just because they tried to escape or whatever. Our understanding is that there's no B order that can change what is here, and therefore this is the Bible in terms of parole.
Chairperson, if I could maybe clarify the 4/5, we were now talking about escapes. They had that policy of 80% for escapes, but if we go back, I've actually skipped this on page 9. You will see there's a big the department is repealing Roman 5, where it was imprisonment contemplated in terms of sections 51 and 52 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act. This was the 4/5 provision. We're repealing this. This was the position where it was minimum sentences. If you were sentenced to a minimum sentence, you had to serve, in terms of our Act, we said at least 4/5. We We're now taking it out. We're saying if you've been sentenced for a minimum sentence, you will serve half of it. So the forfeits rule might now still apply, as you've said, and I think those people that you're referring to might not be the escapees, because I think there were few of those who fall. But the forfeits rule was this minimum sentence, which we're repealing. So once the act, once the bill is passed and becomes an act, it will no longer stand. But we will have no forfeits left in the department. Chair, that's been the end of this provision. We will provide the committee with, like, the simpler handout with that the that we provide to inmates as well. Then, clause 13, amend section 75 of the Act, which deals with the powers, functions, and duties of the parole board. A further function, i.e., that the parole board may decide on medical parole. Look at the thick one, because we were proposing an amendment. Yes. Sorry. Okay, my pages are different, but I'm going to... page 25 on mine. Basically, Chairperson, a further function is added here that the parole board may decide on medical parole. It was an omission. And then it clarifies the position that a decision of the parole board is suspended pending a review of a decision by the parole board. So that's the overall. We will go sentence by sentence just now, but the overall essence of what we wanted to achieve here was, on the one hand, to add in the word medical parole, where it's been left out. You can see that's what we're doing on... on page 25, is we add in medical parole in subsections A, B, and C. And then the other major thing we wanted to do was to clarify the position that currently, if you take a case on review and you refer to the parole review board, it's not clear what happens to the decision of the parole board. Whether it's suspended, the parole board might say, we recommend that Vincent Smith be placed on parole on X date. Now, either the Minister, National Commissioner, or the Inspecting Judge takes this decision to refer to the review board. It takes a decision to refer it. So it wasn't clear what happens in the meantime to that decision. In practice, the inmate would just stay incarcerated until the review board has given its decision. But we have never had it regulated in legislation. So we're just making it clear that, because 99% of the cases where the parole board the issue of taking it on review is that somebody's objecting to it, that we do not want to place the person out. So we're protecting society in the sense that since you do not have a right to parole, we're saying your place in parole is suspended until the review board gives the okay. So we're just making it clear that nobody will be placed on parole until the review board has given its decision. So, but if we go, I think it's maybe necessary again to read through each sentence. If we start then, it says Section 75 is amended by the substitution in subsection 1 of paragraphs A, B, and C. The only reason it's substituted is to add in the word medical parole, but it reads as follows. Subject to the provisions of paragraphs B and C and subsection 1A, place a it's better maybe to read it in the... to start from the Principal Act, otherwise it doesn't make much sense since it's an amendment act. If I could read from the Principal Act, it says, a correctional supervision and parole board, having considered the report of any sentenced offender serving a determinate sentence of more than 24 months, submitted to it by the case management committee in terms of section 42, and in light of any other information or argument may, and then this is now A, B, and C, which comes in that we're amending, subject to the provisions of paragraph B and C and subsections 1A, place a sentenced offender under correctional supervision or day parole or grant parole or medical parole, and subject to the provisions of section 52, set the conditions of community corrections imposed on the sentenced offender. B, in the case of any sentenced offender having been declared a dangerous criminal in terms of 286A of the Criminal Procedure Act, make recommendations to the court on the granting of the or the placement under correctional supervision day parole, or medical parole, and on the period for and subject to the provisions of Section 52, the conditions of community corrections imposed on the sentenced offender. And C, in respect of any sentenced offender sentenced to life, make recommendations to the minister on granting of day parole, parole, or medical parole, and subject to the provisions of Section 52, the conditions of community corrections to be imposed on such offender.
In layman's language, we're saying that the parole board, because you're adding medical parole, they can recommend that somebody goes on medical parole. And then the procedures of medical parole then kick in. Okay. All right.
Chairperson, then B is what we're proposing to remove from the bill. We're no longer proposing to delete those words. That's why on page 26 you will see we're proposing to keep it the position as is. The situation here is that this is regulated by Section 299A of the Criminal Procedure Act, of which I provided copies to the Portfolio Committee last week. And that's why the reasoning the department or the branch corrections initially wanted to remove this reference to the commissioner must inform the board in question accordingly is, as I explained, information around the victim is sent directly to the parole board so that it doesn't form part of his profile, that the inmate can access whatever information about the victim in his own profile. But this process is regulated by that whole provision dealing with victims in the Criminal Procedure Act. And there, unfortunately, it does refer to commissioner. And in practice, this has not been a problem. They just wanted to make it clear that information must never go into this profile. But so we're no longer amending this because we cannot really, because it's regulated by the Criminal Procedure Act. We're just repeating here what is written in the Criminal Procedure Act. So we're just proposing taking out B completely. It is now, if you look on page 11 of the as introduced version, it's the top. B was a second amendment we were proposing to Section 75. We no longer want to do that, Chairperson. Currently in the Principal Act. We wanted to take up the reference to the commissioner must inform the board. We wanted the information to go directly to the board, but we can't because it's prescribed in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act that it goes to the commissioner, delegates of the commissioner sends it to the parole board, which is not a problem in practice. The branch corrections was just over careful to make it clear, but it doesn't go into the profile of the inmate.
Okay.
So it's unfortunate. We wanted to amend it. We no longer want to.
Now, he's got to inform somebody, and that somebody has got to inform somebody, and that son has got to inform somebody whether he may attend. How is it going to work in practice, Chair? That's my problem. You know, we've already found that all these bureaucratic riddles, to the ordinary person, poison ordinary chap on the ground. He doesn't know all these things. I don't know, Chair. You know, we must make things simpler for our people, not make it more difficult. I will tell somebody, and somebody's going to tell somebody, and somebody's going to tell somebody else that he wishes to appear before them. What guarantee is there that it's going to reach the final destination? In what form must it be done, Chair? Telephonically? In writing? How? How do you access it? And this is one of the major problems, Chair. We must make all these institutions far more accessible to the ordinary citizen.
All right. That's your task, to make it far more accessible. But I think the point that he's making is that if it's not a high-profile case, you know, it's only the high-profile cases where we know that Vincent is going to appear before the parole board because Vincent happens to be a high-profile somebody. If it's not a high-profile somebody, and it's not in the media or on the radio, the question that Mr. Abrams is asking is how are the relatives informed that, you know, in a week's time, the guy that killed your child is about to appear before, so that I can then go and say, Mr. Commissioner, I want to have something. How does that thing work in practice? Or does this thing only apply to high profile people that we know every day in the media? How does it work for Joe Soap in the street?
Chairperson, this is definitely an area where there can be improvement, and I know as a cluster they're looking at it. Currently, it only applies to the following categories of offences, and the duty is placed on the court to inform the person, because remember, we only get involved at the end. We only get involved with the inmate who violated this victim's rights. So we never get to do with the victim up front. It's the court and the prosecutor. So what the Criminal Procedure Act says is when a court sentences a person to imprisonment for murder, rape, robbery, sexual assault, kidnapping, or conspiracy, incitement, attempt to commit any of these offenses, it shall inform the complainant, or in the case of murder, any other offense contemplated paragraph by any immediate relative of the deceased, if he or she is present, that he has a right to come and make representations to the parole board. If the complainant or relative intends to exercise such right by making representations, she or he has a duty to inform the commissioner. So the court tells the victim, you can come and make representations, and the victim must then contact correctional services and provide us with the details. There is another process where we try and trace people, but it's never successful, Chair, as far as I'm aware of, because it's years after, especially in murder cases, we're looking at somebody appearing for parole 20 years later, tracing somebody back if the person didn't lodge the details in the beginning. So this is definitely an area where there could be improvement, but the current procedure, as regulated in the Criminal Procedure Act, it's only for those categories of crimes, and that's the process spelled out, and which we've reincorporated into our legislation.
Chair, just as a way of perhaps assisting, because I think it is a big problem, that people don't know when these things are happening. Should one not make provision in the law for notification to have to be made in newspapers circulating in that area that X, Y, and Z parole hearings are going to be held at such and such a place and such a time, and that anybody who has an interest in those cases should supply their details to such and such an address? So a legal notice that appears in the newspaper, so that at least one is informed in a public way, and that the thing doesn't happen, as it were, without anybody being aware of it. I think that would go some way towards assisting.
Person, as I indicated, the cluster is looking at a whole lot of options at this stage, especially at targeting victims at this stage from the prosecutor, because the prosecutor is usually engaging with the victims and the victims' families, and to try and get a database set up from that point, and then that's to deal with people we're dealing with now. And then they are also looking at how to deal with old cases such as, but the problem is we have to look now, we can take on board this recommendation to overall, it's part of the thing the administrator signed in our service level agreement, which we have to improve is victim involvement. But I cannot, at this stage, comment on the costs involved if we have to advertise for each. It will have to be a bit of a study before we just incorporate it right now. But we can definitely take it on board and investigate as part of this whole victim involvement strategy, because it's one of the things also people do not read. Maybe you should do it on community radios or other where people, a legal notice might just not come to the attention of the person involved. But it's definitely an area where we're looking at all kinds of recommendations, and the committee can maybe follow up from its side to ask for regular feedback as to where.
In terms of your inter-DG meetings and cluster meetings, you'll raise it as something that we think deserves more attention, and also the difficulty of it happening. itself is coming up with a suggestion and everybody else is coming to it. We think it's important. It must not just be a paper exercise, and we know that it's not implementable.
Chairperson, Ms. Lowe mentioned earlier that at the time of sentencing, I'm not too sure whether it's at the time of sentencing or is it before a parole hearing that the court will be telling the victim or the victim's family or whoever. Can you tell us exactly at what particular stage does it happen? And secondly, Chair, where in legislation coming before us, there is cross-reference made to various other pieces of legislation. Is it possible that the department would take those particular relevant clauses, pages of those clauses, and make it available to us? So that we can understand in this cross-reference, when you refer now to 276 brackets, blah, 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 of the Criminal Procedure Act, is Greek to many of us. One would like to know what it provides for. Could we have responses to that, Chair?
Thank you, Chair. We did actually provide Section 299A, the one I'm referring to now, on victims last week to the committee. I must apologize. I didn't provide the 276, the sentencing provisions, which was an oversight. When we come back and deal with the provision again, we will definitely now immediately make that available. But the victim provision we did circulate to members last week, and it's at the time of sentencing. That's what the Criminal Procedure Act says. It's when it's in the time of sentencing in those categories, basically murder, rape, robbery, then the court has a duty to inform the victim. But in the other cases, there's no duty on the court. It would be in the discretion of the court.
That's fine. You know, yeah, when you guys sit as officials, you must look at this thing. At the time of sentencing, the magistrate says to Mr. Abrams, whenever Mpo goes for a thing, you are entitled to. Because there's no ways that the court knows that Mpo is going to go on the 28th of November. I'm saying, you know, we put this thing in writing. We know it's never going to work in practice. Because murder is what? We say 50% of the, I mean, 50% of his sentence. So I sentence you to 50 years. After 25 years, you're entitled to parole. What is the magistrate saying to Mr. Abrams? He can't say anything because 25 years from now is, let's say it's 2015. But there's no guarantee that in 2015, Mpo will attend, I mean, will appear, because the parole board will maybe send him back for, the intentions are good, you know. But guys, I think the time where we've been just lying to and not doing what we're supposed to do to our communities must come to an end. After 25 years, we have to learn that certain things we can't do because they were done in the past. If you said to me, and I think this is what the members are asking, if you said to us there was a way where just before, as Mr. Self is saying, just before Vincent appears, there's notification, as unlikely that you will find the victim, but it's better than saying at time of sentencing. At time of sentencing is just crazy. It's just crazy if you sentence somebody to 25 years. You're saying after 15 years, Mamnyanda, somewhere, Vincent will be put on parole. We transfer Vincent from Joburg to Pretoria all over. That thing that you're putting there is not implementable. Somebody must just prove to me, how do you implement that? Because that magistrate won't track when you've been transferred, where you're going to appear before the parole board. The intention is good, Lorette. We're not blaming you, but I'm saying when you guys sit at the cluster, you need to raise these type of things at the legislative level. And we will raise them in our cluster meetings, that these things are becoming, they are not workable anymore. I don't think they're workable, Mr. Self. Or the intention is not being implemented. And therefore, at some point, South Africans are going to get tired of us. They're going to get tired of us because we make promises that we cannot keep. At some point, they're going to get tired. Yes, Lorette?
Chair, if I just could clarify maybe of the role of the court wouldn't indicate to the victim when the court all the court is obliged to do is tell the victim, please go register with correctional services. It is then the parole board's duty in terms of this provision to inform the victim with, and that's why it's also the duty is placed when the victim come and register. The court tells you at the time of sentencing, if you as victim want to appear at the parole board, please go register with the Department of Correctional Services. The victim comes to us, we register him. The duty is on that victim to keep us updated if he changes address, etc. The duty is again not on us in terms of the legislation to follow the victim wherever he might move in South Africa in the 25-year period. But that's the structure of the current process with its faults as admitted from the outset. I must just say it's a quite recent provision. This victim provision was inserted in the Criminal Procedure Act in 2003. Previously, there was no obligation on any role players to keep any data or keep anybody informed. So it is a new provision that's being improved as we go along, I think. Thank you, Chairperson. In C, all we are proposing is to insert again reference to medical parole. C reads as follows. If after the board has approved a sentenced offender being placed under correctional supervision or being granted day parole, parole, or medical parole, and prior to the implementation of the decision of the board, the case management committee reports to the board that the circumstances of such an offender have changed to such an extent that it's not advisable to implement the decision, the implementation shall be deferred until the board authorizes it. We're not changing anything of the existing position, how they handle such situations. We're just inserting reference to medical parole. Then in D, Chairperson, again, it's reference to medical parole and minister that's being inserted here. When the board or the minister cancels correctional supervision, day parole, parole, or medical parole, the matter may be reconsidered by the board or the minister. Within such, the minister would be instances of lifers only. Within such period as the board or the minister deems fit, but the board or the minister must do so within 2 years. This is the existing provision in practice. Is if somebody, if we cancel your parole and you're brought back to the system, it doesn't mean you sit again for another 10 years. You can be considered again within 2 years for parole. That's the current position. We've just added in reference to the minister here for lifers because it's never been stipulated as such, but it happens in practice. It will go through all the steps to reach her again, and then the medical parole. Then 7, despite subsections 1 to 6, the National Commissioner may place under correctional supervision or day parole or grant parole or medical parole to a sentenced offender serving a sentence of incarceration for 24 months or less and prescribe such prescribe conditions in terms of section 52. This is now dealing with the powers of the National Commissioner for people with sentences of less than 2 years. Cancel correctional supervision or day parole, parole, or medical parole, and alter the conditions for community corrections applicable to such person. So again, it's just reference to medical parole, and the medical parole is dealt with in 79.
So less than 2 years,
the commissioner has written into section 79, so that process followed in 79 would be the commissioner applying his mind to the medical reports placed before him. If it's less than, it doesn't go to the parole board. It's the current position as well.
For medical parole?
For medical parole. It's for medical parole, current position as well, Chairperson. If somebody's sentenced, it was always less than 12 months, now it's 24 months, but it's been the position the commissioner decides.
Look at that story and says,
will be there. It will, that will be the medical side of it. The final decision maker is always either for less than 24 months, it's the commissioner, more than 24 months, less than life, it's the parole board, and for lifers, it's the minister. But the process of the medical side of it will be the same. It will be the the practitioner's report, super overseen by the advisory board. That whole process will be followed. And then 8, a decision of the board is final, except the minister, the national commissioner, or the inspecting judge may refer the matter to the Correctional Supervision and Parole Review Board for reconsideration, in which case the decision of the board is suspended pending the outcome of the decision of the Correctional Supervision and Parole Review Board, and the record of the proceedings before the board must be submitted to the Correctional Supervision and Parole Review Board. So here we're... That's the situation I explained at the outset, is that we're suspending the decision of the parole board until the review board has made a final decision. So the person isn't placed out, and then we realize, well, it was an error, and we have to get the person back. Maybe he's committed a crime already for which we will be liable.
Chair, I have no problem with the amendment as proposed, but I have a concern around the institutions that can trigger a review of a decision of the parole board. And it arises really from a very practical situation a couple of years ago, which you will be very familiar with, where there was an illegal decision taken by a parole board. And the chairperson of the parole review board said quite openly it was a reviewable decision, but that he could not himself trigger that review. So what I'm suggesting here is that the minister and the commissioner and the inspecting judge and the board itself can trigger a review of a decision of a parole board. That if the review board on the face of it would appear that they've misdirected themselves or recommended somebody for release illegally or unprocedurally or unfairly, then the board itself can automatically review it. That's what I'm suggesting.
Sorry, could you...
You see, well, let me tell you the practical thing. When Judge Desai was in charge of the review board, there was this case. And he said, yes, of course it should be reviewed. But he couldn't review it because he was waiting for somebody to refer it to him. Okay? And those two institutions in those days before the inspecting judge was added to the mix for reasons of their own did not refer it for review. What I'm suggesting is that in addition to the minister, the commissioner and the inspecting judge, the review board itself, if it believes it's in the interests of justice or good governance or something, may review any decision of any board.
Chairperson, if I could explain. The review board, inclusion thereof, we will have to consult and get back to the committee on that. I don't want to commit myself to that, but we will go and consult. On the issue of a time frame, we can definitely add in a time frame. The review board is made up of certain members of the National Council for Correctional Services. The NCCS sits approximately 4 to 6 times a year. Well, actually 6 times a year, every 2 months. So we can safely say within 4 months, then we are safe. Then we cover at least 2 meetings if 1 meeting has to be cancelled because they don't have a quorum and you can't get those other members to contribute. But I definitely, we can add in the time period, Chair.
I think on the first point of Mr. South, you can go and consult, yes, but I thought you were going to assist us by saying it will be illegal to do it for X, Y, and Z. Because you see, you can go and consult, and in your consultation, the authors say, no, we don't want to put it in. That does not mean that it's not going to begin if we decide otherwise. And including our legal friends here, you would need to come and tell us if we'd be breaking any law if we decided that we wanted to add, and we're being specific in this case. I mean, there might be somebody else. That's all we're asking, because, yeah, you'll consult, and your consultation might come up and say, no, we think it's wise not to do it. We just want to know that if we did it, in the event of doing it, will we be breaking any law? Will we be taking the wheels off something? I think that's the point that Mr. South was really raising about that one. If there isn't, then it's about us agreeing or disagreeing and you lobbying us why we should or we shouldn't do it or whatever the case might be. But if you're not breaking any law, then I think it's something that we'll consider as a committee when we meet as a committee. All right. Happiness, members? Let's move on.
And then really, subsection 9 is added in here just to err on the side of caution. I think the minister may cancel correctional supervision, day, parole, or parole, as referred to in subsection 6, only if the decision to grant correctional supervision, day, parole, or parole was taken by the minister. It just makes it clear that the minister cannot cancel out of her own any other body. For instance, if it's the national commissioner's decision or the parole board, she can't cancel it, but for life or because she placed the life or some parole, so it's limiting herself to that area. Chairperson, then we get to the medical parole provision, section 79. Here again, I'm going to page to. I'm actually going to look at the A list because here we're proposing amendments in line with some of the comments made last week. Let me get there. We're not proposing anything on page 11 of the introduced version. So page 11, the first section is basically the new definition and the role players who make the decisions on medical parole. But what we are proposing is if you turn the page of the as introduced version, on the top of page 12, we're... Of the as printed, yes, Chair. And there we're proposing to add in, we're throwing it wider open as to the role players who can actually bring an application for medical parole. So it's supposed to read, an application for medical parole shall be lodged in the prescribed manner by a medical practitioner or, and then we say, a sentenced offender or a person authorized by him or her. So that's a proposal that came up last week from submissions as why only the sentenced offender, so it can also be a family member or his legal representative, whoever is authorized by him or her to bring such an application. Chairperson, and then the other, I'm going to deal with the amendments and then we can read line by line, or should we, which way would you? Let's start then, okay, let's then start on page 11, I'm sorry. If we start at the beginning, any sentenced offender may be considered for placement on medical parole by the National Commissioner, the Correctional Supervision Parole Board, or the Minister, as the case may be. Now we know which cases it is because it's dealt with elsewhere. It will be less than 24 months Commissioner, more than 24 months, less than life is the Board, or the Minister for lifers. If such offender is suffering from a terminal illness or condition, or such offender is rendered physically incapacitated as a result of injury, disease, or illness, so as to severely limit daily activity or inmate self-care. Here I must add, I've interacted with the SAMA, I almost said lawyers, SAMA medical professionals who are assisting us with the guidelines that will spell out what do we mean with terminal illness, what do we mean with severely incapacitated in practice, and they said end of March they should be finalized, and then it can be presented by the team of doctors to the committee if it can be slotted in. Then, but now...
You see, Chair, the problem here is that we are going to wait for some guidelines. Now, those guidelines will probably be just guidelines, or they may be regulations. I don't know. As the clause is currently constructed, Chairperson, it does not say at what phase of a so-called terminal disease or condition must be before the person can be considered for parole. And then, Chair, if you read it in conjunction with the risk of reoffending is low, it could also mean that a person must then become a vegetable so that that person cannot do anything. That person cannot reoffend at all. So it is too wide, Chair. It does not really answer the needs and requirements for a medical parole. It limits it. Again, Chair, I qualify that it depends on what those guidelines are going to be. But unfortunately, Chair, you can't just go by guidelines. The legislation must clearly state at what stage of terminal illness will the person be considered. What do you consider to be terminally ill? So, Chairperson, this to my mind is a bit vague, and I think if it comes to implementing this, it is not going to be implementable. That would be my submission, Chair. And this definitely needs a serious relook. Well, you see, Chair, you can't read A 79(1)(a) in isolation to 79(1)(b). You see, Chair, then you've got this other limitation that comes in as well in 79(1)(c). There are appropriate arrangements for the inmate supervision, care and treatment within the community to which the inmate is to be released. Now, must a terminally ill person be released to a community, or must that person be released to the immediate family? You see, this sort of, again, places, I wouldn't call it a burden, but it places a sort of a burden, Chair, on the community. And I don't think that should be the intention of the law. And this is a new clause, Chair, so one has to be very careful about its implementation possibilities. And I can see problems as it is now worded, Chair, in spite of those guidelines. And I think Ms. Lowe has already mentioned that they are proposing no change to this. I think the essence of medical parole is not taken in yet. And then, Chairperson, if one looks at the judgment by Judge Van Zyl in the Stansfield case, the Department of Correctional Services actually virtually said that it is unimportant, that particular judgment. And what the judgment said was that individual was entitled to live his life out with dignity. And the department's view was something else. So you see, Chair, when it comes to the interpretation of this clause, if it is accepted in terms of implementation, this clause is going to give lots of problems. I don't think it is a clause that can really sort of be put into effect in practical terms. That's my submission, Chair. And we need to look at this very seriously.
Chair, thank you. A whole lot of issues raised by Mr. Abrams, so I'm going to try and address them. Firstly, why do we not limit terminal disease? And why do we not, in this act, go and list a whole lot of diseases? Because it's impossible. The idea of the new medical parole system is to throw it wider open than the current position, because we have, as the inspecting judge reported in this committee, such a high number of natural deaths within our correctional centers. That is the motivation behind this. So the currently, we're saying, the final phase of a terminal illness. And precisely because medical doctors are having such a problem putting their signature saying, well, this person will pass away tomorrow, and as our own research in the department shows, even where they do that, 80% survive upon release on medical parole. So we're sitting with this problem of final phase of terminal illness. Now we're trying to make it broader, and that's why we've got terminal disease or condition, and then we add in this physical incapacity, which we're basically talking about somebody who's had a stroke, and it's not a terminal disease. The medical practitioners will define this. This will be an annexure to the regulations where we will have lists, and the medical practitioner is the one who makes this recommendation because it's medical parole. But since we've broadened it up, and that's the link to the Stanfield case, and that's where I differ with the position of looking at Stanfield right now. Stanfield dealt with a position where it was Section 69 of the 1959 Act. And in terms of that definition, it was a very broad definition of medical parole. But there were no conditions built in such as reoffending is low. Then why did the department in 1998 came and amended it to final phase of terminal illness? Because there was abuse of the system. And there were no balances built in to look at if somebody is released upon parole, medical parole, under such a wide definition, with not looking at his risk of reoffending, what happens in practice. So then in 79, the department went the other route. The department took and said, well, it's only final phase of terminal illness. So a very limited medical definition, but we do not look at any risk of reoffending because you will basically be on your deathbed. That was the idea. Now we're coming again and we're saying now it's the third period that we want to go in. Now we want to have a broader category of inmates because of the reality. What is this provision about? It's about addressing the dignity of people who are seriously ill and incapacitated in our center. Somebody's had a stroke. He doesn't fall under the definition of terminal illness, but we have that person there. He cannot reoffend if it's determined. But in his condition, we're trying to cater for that category. So now we're throwing open the medical side. We're saying there will be this list, it will be annexed to the regulation. So it will be a confined list, and it's going to be certified by medical practitioners. It's not correctional official to decide the medical conditions that fall within this definition. But you cannot only have the medical side. You must now also, since you've opened up the medical side, you must go and weigh it against the risk of reoffending. Because once again, you do not have a right to parole, and this provision can kick in. We've now got a case where somebody raped a person in 2007, and they're now up for medical parole. It's 2 years later. This person should be serving life. But it's because of the medical care. He's now actually in this final phase of a terminal illness. So that's he falls under the current act. But the point I'm trying to make is this can kick in. That's why we have the risk of reoffending it, because this provision kicks in at any time. Doesn't matter how long you serve. You can be in our center for a week and you can have a stroke, and because of that position, you can now qualify for medical parole. But in order to protect the public, we're having this balancing act. So we're opening up the medical conditions, and that's what will be listed in the annexure. But then they have to balance it against the risk of reoffending, and that will become clearer as we go down. And the issue as to the placement of the inmate, this is the current situation under the current medical. It's always been the case. We cannot place somebody on medical parole if we do not have the third component, if there is not appropriate arrangements for his or her care. Currently, it's a different. These decisions on lifers come to minister, and the options I've seen is some people go to a hospice. some people go to the family because the family really wants to care for the person in that condition and they can care for him. Now he's sitting amongst a whole lot of inmates in a cell, which is really not conducive to his medical condition. But we make sure that there's a clinic nearby. Otherwise, we recommend go stay rather with your aunt in X establishment because it's closer to a clinic. So that's why it is important. We cannot just place this person out because it's a medical condition. But that's why I think it's the three factors that need to be balanced. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, my concern is not much about what is contained in this provision, in this Act. My concern is the objective and consistent application of this by medical practitioners with regards to when they apply this on the inmates. The one might have high blood pressure, the other one got cancer, and they recommend the one, not the other one. And that is where it comes in, this whole issue around medical parole. It's the inconsistent application of this particular provision. Thanks.
Chair, I was wondering whether it's possible to get those guidelines, even if they're not final guidelines, a little bit earlier than the end of March, because I think if we get those guidelines, we might be in a better position to judge whether the words in the Act actually fulfill the purpose that we want. And answer some of the misgivings that some people have about its possible abuse. That's the first point. And the second point is this, just in terms of the wording, and it might have been addressed previously, I'm struggling to understand why it is that a sentence offender may be considered for placement on medical parole by the National Commissioner, the Parole Board, or the Minister, as the case might be. Because does that refer to the lengths of sentences that people are serving? Okay, then I'm answered. Thank you.
Chairperson, notwithstanding the explanation that has been given, I still believe that this particular clause must be looked at very carefully. It is not, to my mind, providing sufficient room for its application. Furthermore, Chair, you see, if you again go to the other amendment that was proposed, these things are all interrelated. Where they say that a sentence that's now on 2 A Roman 2. A sentenced offender or person authorized by him or her. Now, Chairperson, what if this particular offender has lost speech, is unable to coherently apply his or her mind? I mean, fine, the intention of bringing in such a amendment may be good. But I think its application again, Chairperson, is not going to work. It should perhaps say something like, you know, or a person representing the offender. I mean, it could be a lawyer. It could be a doctor, private doctor. It could be a relative that decides that we need to bring an application. That this person is unable to make a decision. So that eventuality should be catered for. The Chairperson, once again, whilst I hear Ms. Lowe saying that we are trying to balance a number of issues, in balancing those numbers of issues, we must always bear in mind, Chair, the constitutional provisions, that everybody has a right to live in dignity and also to meet his or her end in dignity. And we are not taking account of those provisions. And therefore, Chair, I very strongly feel that I agree with Mr. Self. Let's see what those guidelines are. But again, I want to underline, Chair, and place on record that they are merely guidelines. You see, what you need here, Chair, one medical person may define the term terminally ill as being one thing. another medical person will define it as meaning something else. For example, a stroke. From what I hear from Ms. Lowe, it is not defined as being terminally ill. I mean, where a person's, half of the person's left or right is paralyzed. I don't know if that is not being terminally decapacitated. I mean, that person is half a human being. That person cannot do many things. Needs assistance in everything. In many instances, patients who suffer from strokes actually lose their faculties. So, Chairperson, all I'm saying is that if we want to bring this in, you said earlier, Chairperson, that we are not here to come and amend this thing again in a short space of time. You know what the processes are in getting legislation on the table. So when we do a job, let's do it properly. Let's look at this thoroughly again, Chair. But let's have those guidelines. Perhaps one can incorporate something from there into the guidelines. Into the legislation. Thank you, Chair.
You don't have to respond on that one, Loretta. I think we will take it up in the committee. I'm talking about Mr. Abrams' one. Because, some of these things will be clarified when we sit on our own. It's terminally ill or incapacitated. So somebody with a stroke might be incapacitated and not terminally ill. So we'll deal with some of those issues. And also, authorized doesn't necessarily mean it has to be verbal. I could authorize by writing. I could authorize. So some of these things we will deal with. You have our sentiments anyway. I'm not sure if Mr. Max and Mr. Self was answered, I think, on one of them, if not on both of them. I'm not sure if Mr. Max was still requiring, or was it a comment? I'm not sure, Mr. Max. It was a comment. Can we move on to the next one, then, having taken all these into account? Can we? Maybe? Yes. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Then coming to two, this now deals with who may bring the application and how the application must be brought. This is what the essence of two is. This is the initial application. This is not the one that gets verified by the advisory board, which comes in three. This is how you initiate the process. An application for medical parole shall be lodged in the prescribed manner by a medical practitioner or a sentenced offender or a person authorized by him or her, or we can add in a person acting on behalf of the inmate. Yes, we can add that in. The reason we had an authorized here initially is because this person will have to have access to the medical documents of the individual involved. Okay, I'm just going to... And then B, an application lodged by a sentenced offender in accordance with paragraph 2 shall not be considered by the National Commissioner, the Parole Board, or the Minister, as the case may be, if such application is not supported by a written medical report recommending placement on medical parole. All we're doing here is we say, if it's the medical practitioner initiating, it will be based on a medical... We don't want the whole prison population tomorrow to lodge applications if it's not backed up. So we're just making it clear, if it wasn't clear, it must be backed up by a medical report. Again, to clarify maybe here why we don't say correctional medical practitioner in A, two is we want to throw it open as wide as possible. Currently, in terms of our act, you can be seen by, this can be the correctional medical practitioner treats you, it can be your own private doctor, it can be whoever a doctor, because it will go through the second step of that medical advisory board. So the initial report is lodged. This report, the written medical report, must include, amongst others, the provision of a complete medical diagnosis and prognosis of the terminal illness or the physical incapacity from which the sentenced offender suffers, a statement by the medical practitioner indicating whether the offender is so physically incapacitated as to limit daily activity or inmate self-care, and reasons as to why the placement on medical parole should be considered. This is currently the practice. If you look at the forms the medical practitioner must fill in terms of the regulations, this will be an amended form that will be in the regulations, which will have these headings, and the medical practitioner will now, instead of motivating for final phase of terminal illness, he or she will refer to that list that's been compiled and then motivate why it falls within the definition. So that this provision is needed here in order to inform the redrafting of that form that will be filled in. So it just makes it clear what kind of medical report we're looking for. Then we come to. Then we come to.
Chair, even though I haven't spoken to Lorette, if it is agreed that A2 is submitted to read a sentenced offender or a person authorized by him or a person acting on behalf or on his or her behalf, it must mean then on D that an application lodged by a sentenced offender or a person acting on his behalf or by him. In other words, there must be consistency between that B and the preceding clauses, just so that we don't lose that.
I want to be very careful on this one, Jay. This is Roman 2, a statement by the medical practitioner indicating whether the offender is so physically incapacitated as to limit daily activity or inmate self-care. Chairperson, I won't argue this now, but I have grave reservations on this. I would like to look at those medical guidelines so that one can see whether this goes far enough to cover. My problem here is this, Chair, that, you know, everything is in the eyes of the beholder. Someone can read this to mean that this person must be a vegetable before, and that medical practitioner will have to state that the person is a vegetable before consideration can even be given. So it's a grey area, Chair. And it's just that, but unfortunately, Chair, legislation sometimes leaves gaps. And here I could possibly see a gap, Chair. So let us have that. And then we look at this particular Roman 2 again, Chair.
Maybe just say one word before I go on to three on that, is that we must bear in mind that that's the medical condition. Then that medical condition will now still be weighed against the risk of reoffending. So the medical condition, when it's placed before the national commissioner, the minister, or the parole board, they will make a call on the medical condition, because that would have been in that initial report, and it would have been gone to the oversight medical parole advisory board. So by then they're convinced. That's the second thing. You have this initial report that says this guy suffers from this condition. Then it goes to the medical advisory board. They check and they okay this. That's the medical side of it. But now still you must go and look at the usual role of the parole board or these other role players as to the risk of reoffending. So I think we've got two more checks and balances in place, even if the medical condition might not be clear to what it could be right now, but it would have gone through two sets of medical practitioners, and then the usual test of reoffending will now be added to it. So I believe there's much more protection built into society in this application than has previously been the case. But now coming to 3, and this is where the redraft, we're ignoring the 3A in the bill as it stands completely, and this is now making it compulsory, this medical advisory board. It will read, the minister must establish a medical advisory board to provide an independent medical report to the Correctional Supervision and Parole Board in addition to the medical report referred to in subsection 2C. The position here as chairperson in the what the department is proposing is, instead of having a medical advisory board in each province, as was not compulsory in the bill the way it's introduced, we're proposing one medical advisory board for the country, but with regional representation. So you will be appointed as a member of the medical advisory board, but we will have two doctors in the Western Cape because it's a large province, one in, but it didn't make sense to have boards for each one. So we're calling it one board, but with regional representation, which will be dealt with in practice when we appoint people. Otherwise, it will in any case be impossible to get everywhere and to oversee this process. So that's the proposal we're making with the rewording of 3A. And this is the oversight mechanism over the initial medical report. So, and then nothing in this section prohibits a medical practitioner or medical advisory board from obtaining a written medical report from a specialist medical practitioner. The way to understand this now in practice, it actually happens now at the moment as well, is fine, you've had your initial medical report, which said we're recommending medical parole because it falls within the terminal illness or the incapacitated category. Then it goes to the medical advisory board. Now the medical advisory board sees amongst them, say we have 6 in the country of 10, however many we see we need once it eventually is in practice, they don't have the speciality for this particular disease. Then they can still, as the advisory board, refer to a specialist. And that's why we now have the definition of a specialist in here. So then they get this opinion from an independent specialist, because it's just we currently do this in practice as well with current consideration for medical parole, because not all doctors are specialized in all areas, so we won't be able to fill a medical advisory board with all the expertise in the country. So that's just another, if they see they need that, it's made provision for. Then,
Chairperson, can I just raise one or two issues here on 3A and B? Do I now understand that in the printed copy of the book, it says may, the minister may. You have mentioned must. So you've exceeded that it must be must. I'm happy with it. Now, Chairperson, can we also get a sense from the department? You see, the problem here is this, Chair, that all these provisions, that, you know, they can obtain a medical report from some other quarter or another medical practitioner or specialist or whatever. One must remember that we are dealing here with people who need medical parole. Medical. Now, what is the time frame that it currently takes just to apply for ordinary parole? My question is, when framing this particular clause, did we perhaps give it time frames? Did we perhaps think in terms of time frames? That within this or that period, they would be permitted to do A, B, C, D. Because this chairperson is so wide open that if I look at the practical application these days, I mean, we hear these complaints on a daily basis. How long people are waiting? So that concerns me, Chair, that there is one thing to provide a legal provision. It's another to deliver it. How will this delivery take place? Because, again, Chair, we are doing a lot of cross things, that nothing in this section prohibits a medical practitioner or medical advisory board from obtaining a written medical report from a specialist medical practitioner. Now, how will that work in practice? My sense tells me that, fine, the medical practitioner will have given a report in terms of the previous clause, the Roman 2. That statement by a medical practitioner indicating whether the offender is so physically incapacitated. Now, say it goes to the medical advisory board. Medical advisory board is perhaps not satisfied, and it decides it needs a further report from another medical specialist. How long is this process taking, Chair? At the back of my mind is the dignity of that individual. He may have been an offender, but that individual is in need of a medical parole. So, Chair, I'm just asking that before we give our final stamp of approval, we must be cocksure that this thing is going to work. And the way the department is working at the moment, Chair, it leaves a lot to be desired. So I'm worried about that. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Chair. With regards to 3A, where it states that to provide the minister must now establish a medical advisory board for each province to provide an independent medical report at the request of the Correctional Supervision of Parole Board. How independent can this board be if it has been appointed by the minister? This is the one question. Second paragraph, B, nothing in this section prohibits a medical practitioner or medical advisory board from obtaining a written medical report from a specialist medical practitioner. Now, it is limited to those two bodies. What about the right now and of the person, the inmate, which dispute the doctor's or this medical practitioner's report to say, can I also appoint somebody independent from my side to also examine me? You know, I just want to ask whether it is possible. Because in terms of this, he is prevented or she is prevented to do so.
Thank you, Chair. As to the minister appointing, the minister currently appoints the 52 parole boards, the minister currently appoints the parole review board, the minister currently appoints the National Council for Correctional Services. The minister will appoint the medical advisory board. The fact is, if the offender wants to challenge this matter, which is linked, then maybe he can either challenge the independence of those doctors there, or he can challenge the finding that has gone through to say his doctor made a recommendation, it's overturned by the medical advisory board, he can take it up to the courts. Unfortunately, there's no other, if we build in another appeal system where he will get his doctor against our doctor, the best is then to go to a court as the independent arbitrator to say, to resolve the issue, because otherwise we're going to have medical reports back and forth, yours against mine, so then the issue will be referred to a court in the normal process that inmates take us to court regularly. But the idea is that if we have this board and we follow procedures, then that's how you build confidence in the process, as long as it's above board and it's all open. And in any case, these documents will be public knowledge. I mean, it's, as far as the medical condition will be, it will be available to the inmate and his legal representative, so he will be able to challenge it. The time frames, Chairperson, this is a new process. The department is preparing for this process because this process was developed within the department, but I cannot put time frames to it at present. I will have to check at the present moment the average time frame that it takes for a live first recommendation to reach the minister. We're now dealing with people who are recommended December. So it's from end of November, December. Then it goes through all of the channels. But that, again, is the administrative process which we're trying to amend in the department because it's not even set out in legislation. It's where you can, where we will have to regulate this process is now the bureaucracy of who signs off on what. Because to get these documents to the minister, even though you only have the minister as role player here, how does it get from the parole board? Currently, it goes to the area commissioner, it goes to the regional commissioner, it goes to the branch corrections, it goes to the national commission. They can do nothing because they do not have decision power. So that's part of the internal process as we're dealing with streamlining this process. It must come directly to the minister from the parole board because now all they do is they just, somebody signs on top of a memo, but they can't write any comments in there because in terms of the Act, they have no powers. But currently, that's the problem we're facing with LIFERS at the moment. So part of the implementation of this system is we want to get rid, so then it should be quicker, but we administratively will try and manage it as quick as possible. But currently, that's the process that follows. So there's administrative things, but in terms of the role players we've put in here, as long as we streamline it, that there's no bureaucracy in between, then I think we can manage it within a reasonable time period.
Sorry, Chairperson, how do you quantify a reasonable time period? What would it be?
No. I think that we will discuss that amongst ourselves and make recommendations. I really don't want to put you under any pressure and say you made this commitment. We will decide that, look, 6 months or 3 months, and in our oversight we will relay that to you. But I think the point is taken that it must be done sooner rather than later. The bureaucracy must be removed. If we think that it can be even faster, we will say so to you. All right. If you then can move on, ma'am.
Chair, then I'm at subsection 4, in which a lot of comments were received from stakeholders. A sentenced offender may not be placed on medical parole in circumstances where the medical conditions, which form the basis of the medical practitioner's diagnosis or prognosis under subsection 2, were self-induced. As the department explained here, why we want this provision is really in instances where inmates now, since they can bring applications on their own, previously it was just by our medical practitioner, we're opening it up that the inmate doesn't induce his condition so that once he's been placed on parole, he recovers to such an extent that since well, this must be read together with the fact that we will not be bringing people back in terms of the framework we're proposing just because the medical condition improved. So if you take away the one, then you should consider increasing the other maybe, but that's why we have this provision here. Thank you. Then subsection 5. The
one of our stakeholders is arguing that what does self-induced mean? You see, because if I get AIDS, nobody gave me AIDS. It was self-induced. I went and I had unprotected sex or something like that. So does it mean that tomorrow if I become totally useless because of AIDS, that the department can turn around and say, no, it's self-imposed, therefore you're not going to get medical parole? I'm using that example. That's why I'm saying we might, as lawmakers, have to apply our mind to exactly what self-imposed means, or do we want to put limitations to self-imposed? Because, I mean, this is an example used by one of the stakeholders. We're writing these laws for many years. Tomorrow somebody that is not very nice or doesn't think like we think is in charge here. He might or she might then turn around and say, no. This thing itself imposed, we are not giving you medical parole. Why did you do it? Some of us are liberal, others might be conservative in terms of, I'm using the example of the sex, unprotected sex one. So I understand what you the intention is, but we must also think long term. Because unless somebody can say self-imposed, and really I don't want you to get to a point where everything we doubt, you've got to go and have an election and say self-imposed means A, B, C, D, or whatever Mr. Abram said. But I just think that you must apply your mind. We'll also apply our mind on some of these things. Unless you want to make, and you don't have to regurgitate the arguments, but if you've got another thinking, maybe you should tell us. Because for me, it's just that thing that when we come to the self-imposed thing, you're not going to be a medical parole because self-imposed. Mr. Abram's saying somebody must die in dignity. So if it's self-imposed that I'm dying an undignified life, to I get punished because it was self, you know, it's those type of tricky things that we need to talk about. But we will further refine it on our own. But let's take Mr. Max if you want to say something, and then
just quick, Chair. You know, in jail or in the incarcerated centers, or what centers? Centers. Correction. They force you to hang you or to do something. Otherwise, you understand? You're under pressure. Do it, you know, and then it has been regarded as self-imposed. There should be an exception on the rule, you know, who accommodate those things, and as you indicated, the type of illness. So it's not an holiday. People outside think it's a holiday. It's not a holiday there. You are forced to injure yourself or to kill somebody else, and then it can be, it's too wide open to say that it's self-induced. The circumstances around it, it might be different, totally different.
Maybe just one comment. Around the self-induced, if we have a strong medical advisory board, they will most probably pick it up. That's what happened now when we got a second opinion on a lifer who was in a coma because he didn't take his medication. And then at least through the bureaucracy, it took a month to reach the minister. And by the time she followed up on an independent legal, on an independent medical report, the person was fine because he's being treated. So if we've got a medical advisory board that really scrutinizes these cases, then they should be able to pick up where this person will recover once treated, and then the person must just be taken into hospital and treated before consideration is given to such a person. So that is the one side that can be considered if we remove this provision altogether. If we remove the provision and we add in maybe something where if the person recovers, but no, that's another, but I think that's one option, Chairperson, is that if the medical advisory board is really a strong oversight body, it will pick up that the person, if taking medication, will recover. Because that person actually came from a coma once he was just treated. Then subsection 5A, the placement of a sentenced offender on medical parole must take place in accordance with the provisions of Chapter 6 and is subject to the provision of informed consent by such offender to allow the disclosure of his or her medical information to the extent necessary in order to process an application for medical parole, and the agreement by such offender to subject him or herself or herself to such monitoring conditions as set by the Correctional Supervision and Parole Board in terms of Section 52, with an understanding that such conditions may be amended and or supplemented depending on the improved medical condition of such offender. That's why B comes in. An offender placed on medical parole may be requested to undergo periodical medical examinations by a medical practitioner in the employ of the department. The essence of subsection 5, Chairperson, is therefore, firstly, it's the current provision also that this goes through a lot of hands. The offender is to do with any other medical procedure, you must consent thereto that your medical information is shared with everyone. It's the current procedure as well, and when the person can't, it would be his relative or a legal representative in terms of the legislation regulating the health profession at the moment. Then the second part of this deals with, it's the same wherever somebody wants to be placed out on parole, they must agree. It's the standard. If you want to be placed out on normal parole, you must agree to the conditions in order to be placed. Now the same for medical parole. And what we're creating here for the periodical visits is it's a discretionary thing. If somebody's really ill, we won't enforce it. But if somebody has some condition from which he might recover to some extent, since we're not going to bring the person back, we might want to change his parole conditions. Where we previously said he can't work, he must just be confined to his house, we can change it if his medical condition improves, and that's why we want to bring him back for periodical medical examinations. It will be done by our doctors who will go to community corrections, etc. But it's really, this is a practical provision, subsection 5.
Thank you, Chair. On page 29, subsection 1B, the following factors, amongst others, may be considered. And I heard a ma'am said a must. So I want to clarify, Chair. Yes, are we changing all? Yes, it's page 29. Go 6, Chair. My work at, you able? We're at 5. Oh, okay. Yes. Oh, on
5.
Oh, 6.
Then we get to 6, and 6 is a may, because these factors may not always be present always, so that's why 6 now work, 6 in the structure of this section, 6 will feed into where now the first part of this section was basically dealt with the procedure where it's the medical practitioners. It's the medical practitioner, it's the medical advisory board. Now they place that medical evidence in front of the parole board. Now the parole board must apply the second part of the test, which is the risk of reoffending is low. That's where 6 comes in. How does it determine it? It's the normal procedure. We're just repeating it here that it would have done to consider somebody for parole, but we're just listing extra factors which applies in this instance. Therefore, it reads, when making a determination as contemplated in subsection 1B, which is that risk of reoffending is low, the following factors, amongst others, may be considered, because it depends on which are present, whether at the time of sentencing the presiding officer was aware of the medical condition for which medical parole is sought in terms of this section. This comes in with your typical case where it's a cash and transit heist. Person was shot during the arrest. He's in a wheelchair, can barely talk. he appears in front of the magistrate in that position, magistrate still says life, then that's a factor that must weigh heavily against granting medical parole, because he was sentenced as such, and there will be sentence comments to that effect. Any sentencing remarks of the trial judge or magistrate, the type of offense and the length of the sentence outstanding, the previous criminal record of such offender, or any factors listed in section 42.2d. 42.2d are all those factors that usually forms part of the profile. These are may, they won't, this is a balance in determining the risk of reoffending. It's the normal balance that the parole board applies. So it's all the factors such as, has he undergone programs, whatever. If it's a situation where the person has not undergone any programs because he's only recently been admitted, it won't, the determination will be made as to the risk of reoffending, whether it's low. And that's the kind of determination the parole board in any case makes, based not only on whether the person attended programs or whether he shows remorse, or but it's the kind of determination the parole board makes. So that's what this section tries to achieve. Then subsection 7, this is just a cross-reference to another part of the Act, just to make it clear that victims can also be involved here. Nothing in this section prohibits a complainant or relative from making representations in accordance with section 75.4. It's that process we discussed earlier. If this victim told us they want to be at the parole board hearing, then it doesn't matter that it's now a medical parole application. We must ensure that the victim is informed. So I'm just making it clear by repeating. It shouldn't actually be necessary to repeat it here, but I just think for the sake of making sure that the parole boards don't think in this instance they don't have to do this, it's clear. Then subsection 8 is again a cross-reference. A decision to cancel medical parole must be dealt with in terms of section 75.2 and 3, provided that no placement on medical parole may be cancelled merely on account of the improved medical condition of an offender. Basically, what we're saying here is that cancellation, and again, the word cancellation is used throughout the Act. I know it was mentioned during the public hearings, but it's the word used for, we say cancellation of normal parole. So we're referring back to the procedures that kick in when we cancel parole, and we're saying this parole will not be cancelled merely because your condition improves, because we've taken into account your risk of reoffending. We will just adjust your conditions of correctional of parole. Then sub 9 is what we propose to amend. This comes from a request from the committee saying, as I explained, if there's regulations that really fulfill it, a purpose where it's not just daily administration such as this, we can, there's examples of the Justice Portfolio Committee where it's not just placed in front of Parliament to note, but for parliamentary approval. So we've amended the wording here to make provision for and to insert a time frame for this provision. So we're proposing the regulations referred to in subsection 1 must be submitted to Parliament for approval at least 1 month before promulgation, whilst in session or after the next session starts. So we're making provision for Parliament to approve the regulations. And sorry, I forgot that we're also adding in 959, we're saying the Minister must make regulations within 6 months after promulgation of this Act. So then within 5 months, it will come back to Parliament for approval before it's promulgated in the Government Gazette.
That's 9-1
says she must do it within 6 months, and 9-2 talks to the fact that Parliament must approve. Clause 15, amend section 90 of the Act. Section 90 deals with the powers, functions, and duties of the inspecting judge. This is amended to provide for oversight functions of the inspecting judge at remand detention facilities. In other words, it's basically the insertion of terminology. Previously, it read the inspecting judge inspects or arranges for the inspection of correctional centers. Now we're saying and remand detention facilities in order to report on the treatment of inmates in correctional centers and remand detention facilities, and on conditions and any corrupt or dishonest practices in correctional centers and remand detention facilities.
Comments?
No, Chair, that's why we undertook to come back.
That's why I'm smiling and laughing at you here. Because yesterday they fought vehemently about the case. What it means this week is that the inspection does can do everything. If we lose that fight about the police cell being a reminder to the facility, it means the inspection does can't go. So if you accept this one here, you must win that fight. If you lose that fight and accept this one, it means the judge can't go there when they take you out, blah, blah, and go. So now they take you out of the cell because they want to go to the police or something. While it's in the police cell, nobody's going to come and get you. Because the infected judge only takes you in the facility. I'm raising it because you were not there. I think my Mamjanda was not doing it. You were not there yesterday. I'm raising the context. Yesterday we fought. Police cells must also be stripped by taking part of the police cells. Then you must have protection. That seems to be justified to the case. But they are saying, no, that's the judge can only go as far as just when it goes there. So that fight will just come back and fight another day. We will keep it. That is why I'm saying, if you accept this one, we keep. The inspecting judge can only go to the facility. Then you must know which is you must do that by of what the facility is. Otherwise, the inspecting judge will not go to the facility. Okay, so that's also the thing that we're not going to get to the facility. Because we are going to come back and have a discussion around exactly what is going on. Whether it's a hospital or a facility.
Thank you,
all right,
Chair.
Can we move on? Yes.
Then clause 16 inserts a new section 128A into the Act to address identity swap amongst remand detainees and creates an offence. This is now a new offence in the bill that's created. A remand detainee who intimidates or conspires with another remand detainee to exchange identities or to defeat the ends of justice is guilty of an offence and liable in conviction to a fine or to incarceration for a period not exceeding 10 years. Or to such incarceration without the option of a fine, or to both a fine and such incarceration. I know in the initial comments the chairperson indicated that we should consider taking out the fine option and just make a direct incarceration.
Okay, are we happy with that? We're happy with that. Thank you. Another thing, I mean, what are you really doing here? You're criminalizing falsification of ID. Yeah. At some point, you need to look at criminalizing other people, like having a cell phone in the cell. Having a cell phone in the facility and those type of things. At some point, you need to do that. I'm saying that we can live with this. But there are more things that we think should be criminalized. Somebody sitting with a cell phone, right, locked up, constantly put in the machine. You must know that if you find it, then that's a serious thing. Those type of things that I think we should be considering going forward. But as this one stands, basically saying, if I force you to become an instrument, then it's a crime. We're happy with that, right? Right?
Chairperson, I believe cell phones is covered, but we can talk to in another provision in the existing Act.
Oh, okay.
Yes, under unauthorized items, but we will
okay,
just
so
check and come back.
I'll give you the faces and the names of these nations of cell phones.
Thank you, Chairperson. Then, Clause 17, amend Section 134 of the Act, which is the regulations provision in the Act, to introduce a range of issues relating to remand detainees and medical advisory boards, about which the Minister may make regulations. Should I read all of them? Well, the first issue listed here is the Minister may make regulations in future now about the information and data to be kept relating to the incarceration of remand detainees, the safe custody of remand detainees and the maintenance of good order, discipline, security in remand detention facilities, the obtaining, safekeeping, and retaining of information relating to the incarceration of a remand detainee, the location, transfer, placement, and release of remand detainees, the manner in which a remand detainee may make requests or complaints, and how they are to be dealt with by correctional officials or remand detention officials, as the case may be, the diet of a pregnant remand detainee, a child in custody with a remand detainee, and an aged remand detainee, accommodation of remand detainees who are pregnant, aged, mentally ill, or mothers with newborn children, the conditions subject to which a remand detainee may be permitted to have her child with her, the clothing to be supplied to and worn by remand detainees, visits to remand detention facilities by relatives and others of aged or mentally ill remand detainees, visits to remand detention facilities by relatives and others of remand detainees, and arrangements for remand detainee for a remand detainee to consult with a legal practitioner, the provisions of food and drink to remand detainees by their visitors, the admission to a remand detention facility of any person, those amenities susceptible to restriction as a penalty for disciplinary infringements and the amenities allowed to remand detainees, the treatment of mentally ill or aged remand detainees, the conditions and procedures to be followed where an application is lodged in terms of Section 49E, which is the terminal ill provision, the conditions and procedures for remand detainees, of course, conditions and procedures to be followed where remand detainees surrender to the South African Police Service for investigation purposes, that's Section 49F, the conditions and procedures to be followed where a referral is made in terms of Section 49G, that's the take back to the court at the end of a two-year period process, and the composition of the Medical Parole Advisory Board. This will have to be amended, ZA Chair, because it's board now. It's no longer boards. So I will make a note there. But so these are the practical regulations, the administrative side of what is set out now in the bill. Bench Chairperson Clause 18 provides for the amendment of the table of contents to incorporate the new section, so it's just a technical arrangement basically, and that's where we swapped around subsections, but yes. And then Clause 19 now deals with Clause 19 and 20 repeal all the provisions referring to the development of the incarceration framework into the 2008 Act. It's linked to now the amendments we're making to Section 73. So that's just achieving that, and then it's the short title and commencement of the Act. What the committee might want to consider as far as the short title is concerned is whether or not to say that certain provisions may be put into operation at different time frames, or if some of the must comes in where it creates obligations for the department with remand and with the aged and so forth. But at this stage, the Act will come into operation once the way it's currently.
Thank you very much. Just to remind members, we've now had at least two engagements with the department. The initial responses to our stakeholders and this one yesterday and today. The process going forward is that Cindy is going to try and capture the proceedings of the past 2 days. As a committee, we will sit and prepare a report that goes to Parliament, that goes to the National Assembly. What are you going to bring to us? Are you bringing any document back to us?
In light of the comments where we did,
yes.
like it's again not the word agree, but it's yes. to show where the committee said, why don't you change X, for instance, or take out the S that I just found. We will redraft that A list.
Okay, and bring it to us.
Yes.
And so you'll give us another document like this on matters that are not contentious.
Yes. Well, it contains everything.
No, I agree with you. You're going to give it to us, but where we've agreed on matters that
and then, yeah, because my understanding was we would come back to the committee and then where the issues were contentious and we had to go back and find information such as what are the extra healthcare services, for instance, for that one category, that we we want to come and report back as soon as possible to the committee. So, and even the SAPS, we're busy preparing that policy engagement discussion now before Tuesday, even next week, because we thought we were back here on the 16th, but I wasn't sure.
We're not back on the 16th. So when you come back on the 16th, what are you expecting to do?
Expecting to address all the questions raised by the committee
yeah.
over the past 2 days. We're expecting to provide you with a redrafted A-list
yeah.
Where new things have come in or where the proposals, and then the committee can take a final yes or no decision on those or make alternative
okay.
recommendations.
Right.
But we would like to come back to those areas.
So when we, I'm just trying to understand, if we sit here and we decide we want to make alternate recommendations to what you've brought us, you're not going to have an opportunity to listen to them, are you? Or are you going to have an opportunity to listen to them? That's what I'm trying to understand, just the process. If you're going to bring this thing to us having fixed this up, if we decide that 65 years should be 75 years, as an example, we decide that it must be 75 years, what is the process that we follow there? Is that before you draft another one of these, or when? So that we know exactly when we must come back. Do you want us to have that discussion before we meet you on the 16th so that we insist that we want the 75 years and you go back and change it, or do we wait for you to come with your things and so that we don't have too many runnings around? That's what I want to know. Because if you're saying on the 16th when we come back, you want our final answers on a few things, then we must be in a position to discuss them. Yes, Baba, and then Mum.
Chair, maybe I'll propose something before they redrafted this document. I think only what they should give it to us is a conditional list that we will discuss with them, only the document, but not to redraft this until we finalize our discussion as a committee. Because the final discussion as a committee, that's only that will be the drafting of them, drafting the bill as it stands. Now, because if they draft it as we have commented today, and we come back again and discuss it again and change it again, they will redraft it again for the third time, which will be a waste of time. I think they should list only what is conditional for them. They have to report back, and what Cindy has to take us through as a committee, and then thereafter we discuss those two documents, and then they will go back and say, as we have used the 75 years, when we agree 75 years, then this is a position that the committee takes. Then they go to redraft the document so that we look at the final document at the end of the day with them and in a correction for submission to the parliament. That's the only thing that we will cut short of redrafting every now and then.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is the one that I raised yesterday in terms of the visit and communication under Chapter 5. What are we going to do? Are we going to add on this? Because it didn't appear.
No, I agree.
Yes.
That's part of what we want to come... So under each clause, for me it was, if we come back next week, we will take clause one and we will say, this was the issues raised, this is DCA's position, and you would have your position, and then we take a way forward.
No,
so for instance, on that as well, we believe it's covered, I can now say what we believe is covered under Section 13 of the Principal Act, but we would still just want to make sure that everything, that's why we didn't repeat it, because that deals with communication, but we want to be sure that it's in all aspects, that's why... So when we come to, we've listed each of those issues, so we will come and report back on each of them and then clause by clause so that we finish a clause and you will have your position. And
no, what? Yes, I agree with you. I'm just asking between you and Cindy if you can list the areas of contention and that we sit before you come to us so that we at least agree how we're going to approach the areas of contention so that when we meet at your document, where we say red and you say green, we will then finalize them. You might have picked up, so there are not very many of them. You might have picked up some, Cindy might have, if you guys can just do that for us and say, look, this is where we still need to agree one way or the other. And then we agree on that on our own. Obviously, you'll be doing that on your own. You're preparing to come back to us when on the 16th is there? When is the 16th? Wednesday. what are we doing on Tuesday afternoon? Are we allowed to do it? What's the debate? We're doing it Wednesday morning. They're coming back to us on Wednesday morning. When can we see people? Can we see them Tuesday morning? But then we must come back Monday night. On Tuesday morning. What time is the debate on Tuesday? No, we can't have it on Tuesday morning. Can you? Do we need what? How long do we need amongst ourselves? An hour? Wednesday we are meeting the department. When are we meeting Tina to be able to agree on all these positions of ours? We need to caucus before we meet with them. And Cindy's suggesting we do an hour on Tuesday sometime. Tuesday afternoon it's the debate, so we can do it from, let's say, about 11 to 12 on Tuesday. In the afternoon we go to the State of the Nation debate. On Wednesday we have one position when these people come. Is that okay? Unless you are participating in the State of the Nation and you must prepare your speech in response.
Yeah,
that will be the exception. The rest of us can prepare for the Wednesday meeting on Tuesday. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. So Cindy will, because we don't have the time, Cindy will apply for 11 o'clock on Tuesday for us to finalize our position. So it means between you and Cindy, if we can have those areas, Cindy, so that we can look at them on Tuesday. And then when you come back on Wednesday, we will then try and have a final meeting so that we agree on all these positions and take it from there.
There's a suggestion from amongst my colleagues. In doing that list, we're also going to be answering the list, and if it would enhance your conversation, we're alone, that we provide you with our ideas already on Monday morning. Then you can see. Otherwise, I mean, you would have had one position maybe without, because a lot of these issues we have to get information on, so you wouldn't actually be able to have a discussion on extra healthcare practice if you don't know what we're talking. So I think it's there. We're making an undertaking to provide Monday morning 10 o'clock to Cindy our position on all the issues we identify. If Cindy can email me beforehand whatever issues she's listed, so we just cross-check.
No one.